Well, welcome back, everybody. Thank you for a very productive day yesterday, and we're looking forward to getting down to some more details today. I think there was so much to go over yesterday. I don't want to go back through each and every one of those items that we labored through. We think there are some opportunities for us to bring together everyone's thoughts. We think we'll be left with some potential unanswered questions, and what we hope to do in the next couple of weeks is to get back to you in some form. Perhaps it'll be in a survey to get the group's take on the remaining questions that were posed by everybody as we finalize the work product from this meeting. But I thought we had a very good session yesterday in laying the framework for asking the question of how do we select for a family of measures a set of safety measures that are creating a culture of safety. And I want to hopefully ask everyone to keep that theme going through today as we go through some areas where it may be a little bit tougher. The measures that are out there are not necessarily aligned with safety, and it may be that we've got more gaps than we have measures. But we're going to need to take yesterday's experience and critically evaluate the ones that we have before us today. The other thing that happened yesterday that was very good was, for the most part, everybody was clicking on and off their microphones. But when we have too many on, we create an echo on the phone, and it's a little difficult for those who are on the phone just because of the acoustics in the room. So if you're in a dialogue, yeah, keep your mics on. But if you're not, please turn them down so we can limit the echo that for everybody else who's trying to listen in. Lindsay, did you have anything to add? Tom, Connie? All right, fasten your seatbelts. So we'll kick off then by walking us into the medication infusion safety and let's do that. I'm sorry, let me back up a step. At the close of yesterday, we looked at a lot of the thoughts everybody had given us and thought about the pressure ulcers and thought, let's put something up for you to react to. And as I believe, these were there were some outcome measures, some of which might have been competing, and these were the outcome measures that seemed to cover the landscape. But there are questions about any of the measures we would select. So we had looked at these and thought we'd put these up in front of you to react to. The process measures were less in line with safety, and there wasn't a lot of support in the process, so we really didn't put those up in front of you as a set of measures for the family for safety. Not that they're bad measures, but they're just not in the safety family. We've gotten some feedback, particularly about the validation in PSI 3. We went out to the field and did some checking on that, and there was some concern about this being viewed as competing with other endorsed measures for adult pressure ulcers, concern about a false positive rate in higher in adults because adults are more likely to develop a pressure ulcer at home in the setting of chronic disability with and without malnutrition. And the second concern was a comparison of the findings of a validation study that was done on PSI 3. So there's some question really that relates to the validity in PSI 3. And anyway, I'm putting these up for your reaction. Did we want to keep these? Did we want to pull any and all of them? Did we want to substitute them? So if we could go back to our discussion guide and look at the pressure ulcers and get your thoughts about this as our first exercise. Richard?
Frank, I noticed that we talked yesterday about one measure, which was the Joint Commission measure, which I think is 201. And is that also something we're going to consider?
We can. We can consider it. We aren't trying to be partial to one or the other. We were just trying to be parsimonious. So we looked at that as an adult measure versus the PSI 3 and thought we had to choose between one of the two. And we just put the one up as an ARC measure. There's been some challenges to that. But that measure could easily be a substitute for the ARC measure. Sean?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts, and I apologize for not having sort of these data at my fingertips yesterday at the meeting, but I went back last night so I could be sure of it. Just a couple of things which I think would be helpful in terms of helping the choice. The first is that the Brits did a huge evidence-based review, very much like us, looking at how they should be documenting this and what measures they should be using. And their conclusion was, first of all, that it should be new incidents or increase in number along the lines of the CMS, because once a pressure ulcer is developed, there's probably no difference between a 2, 3, and 4 in terms of complications. So their goal was to identify new pressure ulcers. And they also, in that report, noted that if you put it as an outcome variable, then people are going to do some pretty thorough skin assessments when people come into a new institution. So there's going to be documentation of existing ulcers. The second piece, and I think this came to Richard's issue about whether we go 2-3 or whether it's a 2-3 or 4 ulcer, the data on staging between 2-3 and even 4 are pretty lousy, that it gets misstaged very often. And the key difference is it's very hard to miss a 1 versus a 2 because a 1 means the skin hasn't broken down and a 2 has skin breakdown. So that's a long way of saying that I actually think that we should probably pick one outcome measure. And 181 for me covers it because it's the percentage of patients who had an increase in the number of ulcers. I have to go back and look, but I think that's a stage 2. And that would be the one outcome variable that I think would be a good measure of safety based upon the data that we have.
Sean, so I'm looking at that as pulling off PDI-2, PSI-3, and the one outcome is an adult outcome. And what about the nursing home measure?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Frank. I forgot about the issues that you can't extend these to other settings. That would be an appropriate – can I, Connie? Are you nodding?
So we'd have to recognize that that is a current limitation, but as part of when we're thinking about these families, what are gaps or next steps, what we'd want to recommend, the group can certainly recommend that something like an increase in the number of pressure ulcers could ideally be applied in other settings.
Yeah, I would just take that and apply it across. I think that would apply both in home health as the way it is. It would apply in hospitals. It would apply in nursing homes. And I would say it could apply in post-acute rehabilitation facilities. It's a pretty straightforward measure that there's no reason it couldn't go across any facility or any setting.
And pediatrics.
I'm sorry, yes, and pediatrics. Absolutely.
Okay. Dana?
That's really just what I wanted to bring comment to is that I think the I can support a measure that, measures the increased number of pressure ulcers, but across various settings. So whether that can be through one measure or if we have some limitations, but I think that we need to be able to monitor that across care settings.
Great. Bill?
I think a similar comment. One of the reasons I thought number 201, pressure ulcer prevalence, was preferable was that it was applied across multiple settings. So if 081 could be applied, then I think that would be okay. But there, I think when we initially did our analysis, I came down on the side of 201 as a preferable one overall outcome measure.
Heidi, the settings question. Is 201?
It's inpatient only currently.
Right. So this is, I think, one thing we need to give you the next time is not only level of analysis, but also setting of care. So what we've given you is level of analysis. So that's who the measure is would be appropriate to apply to, report out at that rate. We haven't given you setting of care. So if it's something, I'll just try to be ready to tell you, because you cannot assume that facility means it's inpatient everywhere else. It's at the facility level where it should be measured, and then it's probably a different setting by measure. Does that make sense? You're looking confused. Okay.
So knowing that, does that change your thoughts? Okay. So they both, whichever one to choose, across all settings. Okay. Nancy?
Frank, I think we're approaching a consensus here that we'd like a single good valid measure that extends across settings and recognizes changes in either increase in number or increase in severity of the Cubidine. Here's my issue. I have watched people try and take measures developed for one setting and extend it to another, and Sean, I wish it were easy, but it has proven in many cases to be extraordinarily challenging to do. And so in the interim, what I would like to say is perhaps we ought to think about whether the Joint Commission measure ought to be applied now with the goal of getting to a point where we have a single measure that is used ubiquitously and works in all settings.
Okay, that's a great one. Richard?
So I agree. We need to have a measure of this that works, and we need to have a measure that works in the inpatient setting. And I think that just the presence of the CMS no pay possibility, no added pay, has caused hospitals to really engage and do good documentation, which means a good assessment upon admission. And I think it's really started to change the culture. So whether it's stage two or three, I'm less concerned. I think just looking for the stage is important. I think that the measure, which is the PDI-2, actually maps very well to what CMS is already doing. It's a stage three and four, and it's actually defined the same way. So I think it has that merit. And I don't think there's any downside, because I do think hospitals will continue to search for these things. One thing that also dawned on me was if you set the bar at stage two, the patient may come in with stage two and it's present on admission, but may progress to stage three, right? And that can happen quite a few times. So with the stage three measure, at least the stage three was not present on admission, and we're going to capture the fact that it progressed. So I think I would support the PDI-2 as the measure.
So PDI-2 is a pediatric measure. So I guess in my mind there's two questions that are emerging here. The first question is, what is the single best measure that we want to propose to go across all settings? And what is the interim, as Nancy's asked for solution, given the time it's going to take to promote a measure's specification change? Richard, I'm hearing you say you like
PDI-2. You know what? I was reading the measure description. I was just sort of reading ARC's description. I actually didn't see that it was a pediatric measure. So I think we do need a broader measure that works in the inpatient setting. And if there are problems with PS3, then I guess the Joint Commission measure is probably the better one.
So, okay, getting back to the first question, if the Joint Commission was on this list, if we pulled the PSI-3 because of the limitations that have been expressed and we put the Joint Commission measure up there, which is 201, then the first question, which one of these would be the single measure you would like to see across all care settings? if it was spec'd differently than it currently is.
Well, I personally would support increasing the number. I mean, that's the key. So if there were a measure that would look at the increase in the number, and that 0 to 1 is also an increase, so that's what I would, I think, would be the best measure.
Consensus, Andres?
I think the measure that is done with the prevalence survey is the one that's considered the best amongst these measures, the one where you actually turn the patients and you do a prevalence survey once, however often. And that's the pressure ulcer measure that's most widely accepted and most widely used, and it's the NDNQI measure. I think that's the same as the Joint Commission measure, if I'm reading this correctly. I think that NDNQI Joint Commission measure is the quote-unquote best one, whether it's spec'd appropriately for across different areas of care. I don't know the details of that metric, but that would be the best one. There are, and particularly in pediatrics, there are some real problems with the coding, the metrics based on coding. Lots of children's hospitals are not using the POA codes yet, and so the coding measures are really problematic for pressure ulcer. So I would want to totally steer clear of the ones that rely on the ICD-9 coding for these purposes.
So we're down to really two. The Joint Commission measure 201 or 181, the increase in number of pressure ulcers. We can, you know, we can, Dana?
So I guess what are we being asked? I mean, I think we've talked on 181 and the Joint Commission measure. We talked about the strengths of, you know, both. But no one singularly really meets where we want to be long term. I mean, do we need to, because of that, do we need to support both until we can get to that one measure to meet the requirements that we're talking about here?
Yeah, the second exercise I'd like us to do is, if we can't decide between these two, we're just going to say both of these are good measures. Consider them both in the safety family. The next would be, what's the interim strategy until we have a unified measure? And that interim strategy is, what do we want to put across the care continuum? What do we want to put in nursing homes, home health, hospitals from the accepted list? So if we were to accept the Joint Commission as the top, then for reasons that Andrea just stated, then that would be our recommendation as the ideal measure to push across the gaps that are out there. But in the interim, we think that we should have 181 for home health care, the nursing home measure set here, a pediatric, which could be the 201, or it could be the PDI-2. So first question out there is there one perfect measure, or are we going to say that if one of these two should fill the gap? We don't have to be that specific. Nancy?
So I'm uncomfortable because I don't know enough to make a decision between these two measures that at least almost the surface level knowledge we have right now looks equally good to me. But I think it's important to say we want a measure that derives from patient skin actually being assessed physically and counts being made, as opposed to from the claim status, because of the problems we've referenced in the claim status. And we want it to be ubiquitous. We want it to work in all settings. And, you know, here are two that look like they could be a foundational for that effort.
Okay. So that's basically the gap we've identified. Our goal of the best safety culture for pressure ulcers, the gap that we're looking at these measures, we think there's an opportunity to close that gap relatively quickly. Now, that being said, what we want in hospital adult, pediatric, and outside nursing home health, what are the measures? If there's one measure in each one of those, can we put up a measure?
Frank, if I might add something quickly, just in terms of some clarification on 181, because I think there's been a discussion about, I'm concerned maybe that it's claims data derived. 181, because it's home health, They use the OASIS system to collect that. So it's not actually claimed. So I think in terms of the nursing assessment or the staff assessment is captured in the OASIS system. So just to be clear that it's not billing claims, if that was the concern. Okay.
And that was the PSI 3 was the one that a claims-based study came out and said there's issues with validity. Sean?
Can I put something on the table to be shot down, Frank? why don't we suggest 181, which covers home health, 679, which covers nursing homes.
Those are two.
Right.
I'm sorry. We put two together there. My apologies.
I'm sorry. The two together, because that covers long-term care. And then the Joint Commission, which covers the hospital, which are the three major sites for where this is a safety issue, as the interim solution, with the gap analysis that we want one measure that is patient-specific screening that mirrors what the Joint Commission recommends across those three settings in the future.
Thoughts? Nancy?
I like that. I'm a little confused by the 679 and 678 being lumped together here. Is there long stay as in nursing home and short stay as in
nursing home
skilled, yeah. Short stay nursing home skilled? But it would be clear that any one institution was in one category or the other, or that a group of patients was in one group or the other. So you weren't trying to figure out on the fly whether I have to report this to that category or this category, right?
So the MDS currently does make that differentiation.
Anne-Marie, were you?
Are we including, I'm getting confused, are we including pediatrics then when we use those three? They're all adults, aren't they?
No, Andrea, we would be using the Joint Commission for Pediatrics. Is that okay?
I have to make that decision right now. I'm not sure that metric has been, it's used, but has it been used? Like, you know, it's sort of been, there are places that do it. I would need to understand better, more broadly. People are using it, but I don't know. Especially places that are trying to do MAGNET and that kind of thing, places that are trying to do the NDNQI metrics are using it. But I don't know what the sort of scope of the literature is on that.
Could the answer be that it's the Joint Commission or PDI2, where it's not you, where the Joint Commission measure isn't used?
I mean, if you had to choose, I think that those ones based on claims are total zeros. Like, I'm not sure that that's going anywhere that's meaningful. I'd rather go with the prevalence survey in that regard.
But if they're not doing it?
I do think lots of places are doing a prevalence survey. So really the question at heart is if it became sort of mandated, if you will, right, that this was the way to go, I think that's not unreasonable. Although I'm cautious because, as Nancy said, I think some of these metrics need to be explored in more detail, but I think that metric is pretty reasonable regardless.
Okay, Richard.
Looking at 679, 678, it looks like 678 is really subsumed under 181 because it's new or worsened increase in number. That's, to me, same thing. 679, the difference is one looks at the percentage that have an ulcer and one looks at the increase. So to me, a certain number of long-stay residents are going to have ulcers and some will arrive with ulcers, so we're looking at the prevalence of the ulcer. I'm not sure if the prevalence is what we really want. I think we want the increase. Did the number worsen or and is there a new incidence of an ulcer? So I would think 679, 678 don't add very much.
So they, in your mind, they're not really contributing to safety since they're prevalent.
If we have 0.81 or 181.
That's in home health now.
Oh, It's only home health. Well, in that case, 678, new or worsened, is what we want, and we want that for long and short term, not just simply short term.
Okay. David?
So I just wanted to comment as related to the CMS 201, as related to pediatrics, that I think that, you know, part of the issue is that we don't often think about pediatrics with, you know, having, you know, decubitus ulcers and skin breakdown. But the fact is that nurses are assessing, you know, patients, you know, pediatric patients in the inpatient setting for skin breakdown and the prevalence of, you know, of ulcers. So I can't speak in terms of, you know, to the extent that this measure is being used right now in pediatrics, but as Andrea said, it is being used in some settings. But that's something we could probably do some more research on, too, just to validate that.
I do think that pediatric skin issues are really different. So kids get things from long OR cases. They get things from lying on their head. They get, you know, pressure ulcers on their head, on their face, and at different places from tubes and stuff. So there are some differences, but you would capture that in the prevalence.
So I'm hearing good consensus around 181, around 201, and it's kind of mixed on, and I think Richard raised a good point on 679, 678. So let's focus on 679, 678 and where we go with that one. I like the points you made, but I want to know where our consensus is. Dana?
Sorry, just to digress for a moment. So I just got some late-breaking information that this measure through NDNQI, the 201 CMS measure, is being used across all unit types to include pediatrics.
There you go. We really like it now. So 181, 201 sounds like they're in. We're dealing with the nursing home issue, 678, 679. Helen, did I just?
At the risk of sort of carrying this conversation backward, I wanted to ask about the two that were based on claims data. If we eliminate those, will they not be used anywhere? I mean, because it strikes me, especially if these have to be, you know, recorded as present on arrival, that you want to be able to get them from claims data. That's the most, the easiest, the most effective way. And the idea of every institution having to turn every patient in order to find out, to measure their pressure ulcers. Seems like a lot.
I don't want to suggest that this family is the all-inclusive family. There are other work groups who will be looking at other conditions and could well select these measures as part of their family. But as a safety set, in that umbrella of a culture of safety, what we're saying is that 201 will pick up what we're looking for in terms of that thought about increasing the number of pressure ulcers as a safety issue. And you'll have to do the present on admission assessment to do the increase assessment.
Right. And but you could also do the increase through the claims data. I think the claims data are very valuable, and I don't want to throw them out because I think that really sort of sets us back in a lot of ways.
Okay. So any other thoughts on that? I mean, we've got contradicting evidence to say claims data aren't valid, and that when we do a prevalence survey, which is a chart review, you know, the way they do it, it's more valid.
Right. Well, the chart reviews, I mean, no data is perfect. Chart reviews aren't all that great either. I like what Sean was saying about, you know, the increase in the number, and we have a current study on that. But I think that you do have to accept that claims data is not perfect. The charts are not perfect either. But if you're making your claims based on this data, it certainly should be good enough to measure what you're doing. It strikes me as an odd argument that what you're being paid for isn't good enough to be assessed on.
Well, the goal of payment is in clinical assessment. The goal of payment for treatment of a pressure ulcer isn't the goal of the testing whether the ulcer increased. They're not linked. That's been the problem with claims. It's a payment system. It's not a clinical system.
Well,
we're trying to extract clinical data from a payment system, and it runs, it gets you so far, but let's say it's 70% accurate, and doing chart review is 90% accurate. Which one do you want?
I think you want the one that would give you the most data. I think what you need to do is focus on cleaning up the claims data, because I think that's the problem.
Okay. Dan?
Helen, I would disagree with that. I think we need to look forward to the future, and that we need to think about moving more towards clinical data and assessment data and how we can actually utilize that for monitoring, surveillance, and reporting. And that is where I think the whole initiative around EHRs and other technologies to be able to provide that information is the direction that, you know, we need to be in this, you know, in this country in the future. And understanding we're not there today, but we know and we live with every day with the limitations of basing reporting on claims data. And we've really got to move towards the patient information and the clinical data.
Well, we need to move toward electronic information, I agree. And this is the electronic information we have now. And I don't want to sidetrack us with a big conversation about claims data, but I think it is important to use what we have. I think it's more, it's broader data, it is less subjective, and it is less of a burden. That's what I've seen with infection reporting, where I've really been involved with this closely on state level. It's just such a burden on the people who are trying to collect that data that it needs to be electronic. They shouldn't be having to spend all their time inputting data.
I don't want to say this is sidetracking it. This is to the heart of PSI3. It is claims data, and it's considered by those on the clinical side to be invalid. So you're right on target bringing this up. And the issue of burden is the advantage of claims data is it totally limits the burden compared to getting the clinical data set. The question is, really, if we have a way of getting more reliable clinical data that's more valid, do you want, and yet it's more burdensome, do you want that compared to claims data? And I think you're raising a very valid question that the group should talk about.
Well, I think you can't get as much of it if you're relying on clinical assessment, particularly if you have to redo it every time if it's not even from the chart, if it's a prevalence survey.
Let's get other comments. Sean?
Well, I was going to move to something else, Frank, but do you want me to stay on this one?
Let's stay on this for now, and we'll come back.
I guess, there's two thoughts. I mean, the first is that the data, particularly on pressure ulcers, are very clear, Helen, unfortunately, is that without a day where you essentially go around and turn every patient, you don't detect them, you don't identify them. They're underdetected, they're unidentified, even though there's a quote-unquote requirement for skin assessment, they just don't show up in the claims data because it's just not done. In fact, the biggest intervention was the Joint Commission's requirement in hospitals. It says you need to go on one particular day and look at every single piece of skin. And suddenly we detected them, and suddenly we saw a huge decrease. I wish it were different. I really do. And I wish that the claims data were accurate on this one, but they're not.
My concern on that would not even be the data. If people are not detecting them, they're not treating them. That sounds like a pretty serious situation that should be addressed in a different way.
I agree, and I think that's why it's in safety rather than in quality and something else, because it's been elevated to the issue that this is a safety issue. And you're absolutely right. It's intolerable and inexcusable, but I think that's why NQF put it on the safety issue, because it is so important. And because it's so important, as you say, you're right, because we miss early stages. And once, you know, the skin is broken, the increased risk of sepsis goes up. Once you're through the dermis, the increased risk of skin flaps goes up. So that's why I think it really is a safety issue, and I think that's why we can't afford to use claims data to find it, because we know the gaps there, and it is too important not to do it in a sort of other. My second point, which is pragmatic, which I'll get Heidi to look at while we're looking. Heidi, my quick look at it, and the data aren't there, is that 678 and 679, I got to get the NQ, are complementary measures. This comes back to Richard's issue, that for the first 100 days, you fall into 678, and then the second 100 days, that same patient then goes into 679. So somebody comes into a nursing home, and for the first 100 days, they're covered by 678. And then on day 101, could you check and see that if you hit positive on 678, are you then a positive on 679, or do you go back to zero? Because I think that gets at Richard's issue. Because then 679 will capture all new ones if 678, can you just look at that? Because I couldn't find in the details. But
yeah,
that would get us out of that problem that Richard identified.
So the way that the long stay measure works, which is 679, the denominator is all long stay residents, so that's anyone who's 100 days over, who received an annual, quarterly, or significant change or significant correction assessment. So at some point they did an assessment during that quarter and is high, what they call high risk. And high risk is comatose, impaired in bed mobility, or transport and suffering from malnutrition. And then it looks to see the number, the numerators, the ones who have been assessed and found to have one or more stage 2 to 4 pressure ulcers. So it just looks to see, of the ones that are long-term, long stay, did they have a pressure ulcer, one or more?
Right, but my question is, when they operationalize that, what happens to the person who was covered by 678 in that nursing home? And then has the pressure ulcer documented, and then day 101 goes into the next group. Are they then double counted, or does that one drop out? Because that gets at Richard's issue about prevalence versus incidence.
I'll go back and confirm, but I think they start out new and they are in that denominator. But I'll have to go to the developer and confirm. Can I add a little clarification on 201 as well?
Sure.
Because I went back and I looked to make sure I had this right, and I'm confirming it with the developer because I want to make sure. It's showing that in our database that it is broader than inpatient, so that's what I want to confirm and make sure it is indeed correct. But it is, based on what I'm seeing here, hospital, acute care facility, inpatient rehab facility, long-term acute care hospital, nursing home, skilled nursing facility. So 201 actually may be broader. I want to, again, make sure that's correct. But it does not include the pediatric population, as it's written here, they exclude anyone 18 or younger. So you actually could have one measure that goes across settings, but not the pediatric population. So if they're in Chicago, it's early, so I probably won't get an answer immediately, but I will see what I can find out for you.
And I'm sorry, I didn't hear home health on that.
So you do not have home health. Home health is separate. 181 would be the one.
So it'd be 181, 201 would cover the gamut.
Yep. Except for your pediatric.
Except for question mark on pediatric. Okay. Amy, you went up and down.
I guess I was just saying to add to Helen's thing. I mean, I understand that we're not getting the specificity and the clinical use out of the claims data, but for purchasers and in many cases for public reporting for consumers, that's what we have. And in the absence of having other measures that are publicly available to us, we have to go with what we have, and we're willing to work to risk adjust that, to make that more accurate, to, you know, work to improve the quality of that, and we're willing to use other measures, but this is information that patients and purchasers and consumers need to have available to them. And so measuring it in such a way that it's not, is just not going to work for us. So that's just what I wanted to throw out there.
Andrea?
Let me try to speak just a little bit to this comment about this metric. This prevalence survey metric is actually a nice metric for a number of reasons, despite this issue of the burden and the concerns. One of them is because it's about the work of it. So what this does is it forces you once a quarter to mount your entire place to think about pressure ulcers, and that's very valuable, and that drives improvement in and of itself. This is it's in many ways, it's a much more robust measure than any of these other kinds of things that you're talking about, because it's both the work of it and the metric of it, and it has the potential to, you know, if you really start doing this properly, it's meaningful. So I actually completely to me, this conversation about whether or not there should be billing data used for this is doesn't make a lot of sense, because there is a decent way to get at this, A. And B, I think it also sets it up well for what I consider to be the big gap going forward, which is around the potential for electronic measurement out of electronic medical records, because a prevalence survey is whether you do it once a quarter or once a day. In the electronic medical record world, in theory, we'll be able to do it once a day because we'll have some documentation-y thingy that's going to flow into a metric. And so it won't be limited to once a quarter as it is now because of the burden issues. So it sets up nicely for a progression into a more electronic world if and when that ever happens. So I think that both reflects a good preparation for the gap as well as the fact that this metric has meaning beyond the metric in and of itself. And I think that is helpful to address that. So I don't think that the burden is inappropriate in this particular issue. I will say that the pitfall with this metric is that you cannot do it properly. So the right way to do it is you mount a team and you turn all the patients. The less burdensome way to do it is you call the units and say, hey, you got anyone up there with a pressure ulcer? And so there are places that work around this metric by just calling up and to the units and then, oh, yeah, no, unit, you know, 7 has one, 8 doesn't. And that's where you get – that can – and obviously, you don't use the metric and apply the metric properly, you get garbage.
Nancy?
Thanks. I think there's another problem with this metric that we, in trying to use or measure pressure ulcers through claims data, and that is in the claim, what gets recorded is one pressure ulcer. No matter how many you have or how often they occur, it gets one. And since one of the critical issues here is the worsening of the increase in number, that really, you cannot see that in claims data, period. And that's one of the reasons, one of the fundamental reasons this is not a claims-based measurement that can be accurate or effective. But Amy, to your point, what we're talking about here is promoting measures that would be used in national public reporting systems, and the Joint Commission measure is applied across all patients, regardless of payer. Should be if we choose to use this in our recommendations for what goes up on Hospital Compare or other things, would be across all patients, available to all, publicly available. That's the goal here, and so I think your cry for patients and their families to have this information is right, and I think it's worthy of making publicly available by institutions. Frank, I want to just tag for you an issue to come back to when we get through with this discussion, part of the discussion, which is the application to the clinicians.
Okay. Richard?
Yeah, I want to just say a word about this discussion of using coded data. Claims data is not the same as discharge abstract coded data, all right? That forms the basis of the claim. But the discharge abstract, after the introduction of the CMS NOPAY, the ICD-9 codes had to be revised to include the stage of the ulcer. And also, there was the introduction of the POA flag. So while it may be the case that the ARC measure does not incorporate those and therefore maybe is not a good measure at this time, I don't think we should discard the concept that we could look for some of these, notwithstanding Nancy's reservations, which are valid, we could look for some of these with the coded discharge abstract data. So if hospitals are not using those codes when there's a stage 3 or 4 ulcer because it does impact payment, they do so at their own peril. I understand in the pediatric world it's different because they haven't been subject to the CMS regs, so it may be quite different. But I don't think we can totally exclude the possibility of using the newer ICD-9 codes with the present on-admission flag to get at some of this. It may just be at the moment the tool is not adequate.
So right now what I'm hearing is 201 across setting, 181, and the question mark is pediatrics because the PVI-2, Andrea has made the case, is inadequate, and there's a question whether 201 crosses into pediatrics. Is that a fair summary? Okay. Damon?
I go back to say, I mean, I understand what Heidi reported out from CMS and how it reads, but Indian QI using this measure across its hospital and the magnet facilities, they are using this measure in pediatrics with effective results.
I mean, we can explore that after the meeting. We can look into this and work with the Joint Commission and see where it is, and it could be something we can get back to you. So Nancy and Sean, I think you might have had outstanding issues in this group.
No, as long as the TJC goes across into long-term care, Frank, none at all.
Okay. Nancy?
And I just wanted to raise the issue of there's an implication that some of these measures apply to the clinician, but without definition of and could be used, for instance, in a world or a payment policy related to clinicians, the implication I was taking. And I think the relevant clinician here is, most importantly, the nurse. And I just wanted to sort of verify that and talk about whether, in fact, we ought to think about this as a clinician measure for payment program purposes or whether this is really more nursing quality, which is not paid separately from the hospital or the other facility.
So, I think so. So, Heidi, we've got 181 and 201, and the level of analysis for 201, I guess I'm not sure what clinician team means.
I'll pull up the definition to make sure I have it correct, but it's getting more at looking at, it's not one individual, it could be a unit, it could be, I think that's what is intended there. it's not a what you would consider a practice or a group. So it is the in-between. I'll have to look up how we defined it, but it is intended to get more at the concept that it's more than just the physician, it's also the nurses' aides, everybody else who's involved providing care.
Does that answer your question as well as we can for now?
I think so. Just to say it back in a different way, I think it's that this measure is probably not right for inclusion in the physician payment, whatever they call that.
PQRS, it's
yeah.
Not.
Yeah,
that's
thank
one
you.
Thing. It's in a team, it would not be because it would be individual clinician.
Great.
And that would be where it's appropriate.
Right. Thank you. That's the clarity I wanted.
Dan?
So which raises the question, are we doing this for physician payment or are we doing this for quality of patient care?
Well, the programs are put through, the way that CMS utilizes the program or applies the program is for quality and patient care through a payment program.
Right. Then I think that raises the challenge there and creates the paradigm that we are where we live today is that the quality programs are very much, you know, physician focused in terms of for physician payment versus really looking at true value and quality for the patient. But that's probably a discussion for another time.
No, this one, what we're saying is this is non-physician. These are in non-physician programs. So this would be payment to home health care. This would be payment at the facility level. But it goes in a program, one of, I guess, somewhere around 20 programs that are out there. Richard?
Yeah, so just to mildly disagree, I don't believe this is tied, driven by physician payment because it's the fact that hospitals are now subject to possible penalties has caused a change in the nursing assessment and the way that the nursing assessment is done with much more diligence. So, you know, I think the fact of the matter is there are not many, probably not many, payment penalties for the three or four, but they've just caused a change in assessment and culture, which I think has been a good thing. So they're not mutually exclusive.
Okay, I think we just finished yesterday. And we can move into the medication and infusion safety. We have Andrea, Sean, Sheck, and Michael's not here. So, Andrea, do you want to share your thoughts?
Sure. Excuse me. Well, first I'll say that I'm sorry I'm directed this way at the microphone. Don't mean to not look at folks, but the I'm sure the clinicians on our group have a lot of clinical information to share, and there were a lot of measures in here for us to look at from a purchaser point of view. I tend to go through these things pretty logically. So on page 20 of the legal spreadsheet, we would recommend 419 over 97, which they're very similar measures, but the it covers a broader age population and a broader patient population. So of those two, 419 is preferred. If you look on page 21, none of the discharge, the medication discharge measures on 21 are ideal in our opinion, because the ones that cover the broadest populations have too long a reconciliation window, and those that have a shorter window, such as 293, you know, that's not ideal either. So none of those measures really hit the mark, and so we might be talking about a gap potentially here. But of those four, 554 is, because it has broad application to the individual and group clinician level, as well as the health plan, which is a goal, so it's covering a broad group, that would be preferable. And even though 293 has a small window, it definitely is one that at least CPR and CPR purchasers believe that would rise to the list of inclusion. And then finally, I'd also would include, if we go to the next page, or 23, you know, at the risk of recommending something that there's a lot of compliance with already, the transfusion reactions, 349 and 350, are ones that are, I think, seem to be more like a never event. So they just really shouldn't occur, and that's potentially why there is significant compliance and equality already occurring in that area. But I think I wanted to mention it because it has that sort of never event quality to it. And I did want to refer to one measure that was not in the summary list. It's actually on the larger spreadsheet. And it is it's not an NQF endorsed measure, so I guess it's really more of a question about that. It's the implementing of drug-to-drug or drug allergy interaction checks. And so that those drug-to-drug or drug allergy interaction checks seems to be a pretty critical item, and it's, like I said, it's not NQF endorsed, so maybe the question really is more about that discussion, which I'm not familiar with. And I don't want to completely jump to the gap discussion, but for the parking lot, we heard a lot yesterday about pain, and so I think potentially under medication safety, we also might have some pain medication gaps. I mentioned the transfusion reaction as sort of a never event, but we also had a discussion yesterday about over-transfusion, and so potentially that is a measurement gap that could get captured here. And then in the discussion questions, there were, you know, what other measures are missing? And I think one of the things would be sort of the HIT measures to reduce the adverse drug events. So I guess those are more for parking lots, but those are my remarks. And, oh, I should say, on the transfusion reaction, I understand on the summary prioritization sheet, it's scored low because it doesn't probably directly meet the three I's. But at the same time, like I said, it does strike us more as sort of a never event and kind of smaller. So, thank you.
Thank you. I would note that those transfusion reactions, PSI 16, PDI 13, are currently in NQF reserve status. So, and I think that means they're inactive reserve. Sean?
Yeah, I agree with everything Andrea said, and I must admit I was woken up at 3 o'clock this morning by the wife of one of my patients who I had discharged to a long-term care to say he was on the way to the hospital. And he's actually dying of a bowel obstruction this morning because the nursing home forgot to keep him on the laxative Suvazon for his opioids. So he got transferred. And so I'm a little bit not coming from this from an analytic standpoint, and I apologize for that. But, you know, huge medical error that they just didn't continue it. So, so yes, Andrea, to both. Just quickly going through, I agree with what Andrea said. My concerns were, I'm hoping that 176 and 520 are, what's the right word, Heidi, complementary measures. One is that if they're both related to home care. One is instructions on home care meds are given to patients, and the other there's improvement in compliance. My issue is that I do have some people who have, there is no room for improvement because they actually do really well with their meds. So I think that they're complementary and they address the home care. I agree, you know, that I like 554. It overlaps with 97. I think the 30 days is probably better. 646 is the medication reconciliation list. I think that's absolutely critical. And I do think that the 419, the medical documentation, and the medical reconciliation on discharge are both key variables and key measures that need to be included. I 486 is a structural measure that I'm not really thrilled with at all. That's e-prescribing. And actually, I think 293, transfer of medication information to the hospital within 60 minutes, I actually think that's too long a window, but I'm happy with 60 minutes, to be honest with you, because many decisions are made. Frank, do you want to talk about the warfarin monitoring? You want to go through the whole thing, warfarin monitoring as well?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. 555 is straightforward warfarin monitoring. I would include it, opt to include it. 556 is warfarin monitoring after antibiotics are started. I think that's a critical gap for safety and one which we often miss. I would include it. And I think 586 and 612 overlap with 555, and I think 555 covers most of those. And I agree with Andrea about the transfusion piece. Was that too fast? I'm sorry. Was that too fast, summary?
Yeah, but I liked it.
Okay.
I don't know that I got it all, but we'll see. Sheck, are you there?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I'm sorry I'm not there in person. I just had some transportation issues. But I think I agree with a lot of the stuff that both Andrea and Sean said, and I think the main themes kind of revolve around...
Hang on just a second. We're trying to turn up the volume.
Sure.
There you are. Go ahead.
Sure. I think a lot of the... I agree with a lot of the stuff that Sean and Andrea both said. I think most of the main themes that revolve around medication safety are around reconciliation monitoring and patient education and understanding of therapy. The one thing... I guess I do kind of support the structural measure on e-prescribing. I think that's one of the important areas where there could be a lot of improvement. And I guess maybe just going down the line, both the first 176, the outcome measure, and then 520, I agree that they're important just based on medication adherence and understanding that. you here. I also kind of agree with both of the previous commenters on parsimony and medication reconciliation. And again, it should be expanded to patients that are younger than 65 years of age, so the 419 endorsed measure as well. I'm just not sure for measure number 293 how that information should be captured. I agree with the purpose of transferring the medication information within 60 minutes. I'm just a little confused about how that information would be captured. And I noticed also the difference between the handout and the number of measures and then the Excel sheet as well. And I noticed that in the Excel sheet, there are a lot of measures pertaining to medication monitoring. And I know that the comments over on the right-hand column of that Excel sheet noted that there are issues with some of the measures being too narrow. But I don't know whether this could also be a gap as to maybe support the development of measures that kind of pertain to monitoring, because that's another really important piece in terms of medication therapy. And then with the warfarin measures as well, I think there should be a little bit more parsimony, maybe surrounding consistent monitoring and sort of more of a focus on longitudinal, like the longitudinal aspect and understanding of warfarin monitoring in ambulatory settings. I'm sorry. And then for measure number 646, on the percentage of patients, I think it's discharged with medication reconciliation, I guess the information. I think it's an important measure, but I think one of the more important aspects of that is actually the patient understanding their medication therapy. And I don't know whether that measure would really capture that if it's just a piece of paper that's kind of handed to the patient as they are discharged. So I guess those are the only things that I was really worried about.
What I'm hearing from the commenters, just trying to read back to you, is that there's an overwhelming safety issue here, and there's just it's almost which one of these don't you want rather than which ones you want, because I was checking off as each one of you spoke the ones that you found value in, and I've got only a few that had limited value, and I can't argue they all have a safety feel to them. So I guess my question to you as you're making your comments is really you tell me what you want on the list, but more importantly, probably tell me what you don't. Barbara?
Morning. Question is there a presumption that if you require a reporting of medication reconciliation for the post-65 that it creates a culture which is applicable to the under-65? Because these are all for over-65s, and I'm wondering why.
Sure.
So that same question has come up when these measures have gone through the most recent review in the care coordination project. Most of the developers first, it was dependent setting perhaps they were looking at. They only looked at the geriatric population. One of the requests that has gone back to the developers, and they're all looking to see how they can do is expand it to all ages. Because 646, if you look at the inpatient, that one is all ages, and so that's the request. It's going to take some time, but that's the hope.
Frank?
World,
you're Frank.
Barbara, you do it. To be honest with you, the research is all...
Richard?
Yeah, so I want to agree that this is a very important area. Probably one of the most important impacts things like unnecessary readmissions, unnecessary trips to the emergency room, so it has a huge cost. I think the measures that we have are entirely inadequate, so I think this is a huge gap. And I guess I'm in a glass half empty kind of mood right now, but I see many problems with what we have here, I mean, I agree the timing of 60 and 30 days is totally inadequate because you'll know within 30 days by another mechanism if you haven't reconciled. I understand 419. I like 419, but I don't understand when this is done. So when do we document that there's a list? If we do that at the time of admission, it's worthless. During the hospital stay, it's worthless. Because what's really important is, does the patient understand what they're on when they're leaving the hospital? So I'm troubled that there's no timing in 419. In 646, I think it's fine to make sure that the patient has a list. I mean, that's the bare minimum. But some of these lists, you have to understand, you know, the patient is given a list of drugs with their generic name. They have no idea which ones are in the same therapeutic class. These patients don't have pharmacy degrees, and then they're expected to understand. And so a list, to me, is only as good as it's the patient's ability to comprehend the list. And so just by saying I've given you a list, I think, can be in a way self-defeating because we've checked the box and the patient still doesn't have any idea what was stopped, what was started, and why. So that troubles me. I like 5.4. I think that's something we should know. The e-prescribing, you know, I think, sure, we should have e-prescribing, but to me the trouble is not e-prescribing. The problem is not that the pharmacist fails to receive the right medication order. The problem is the patient doesn't understand when they get that bag of drugs which one is in the same therapeutic class as the red one. And so the e-prescribing, I'm afraid, can actually lull us into a false sense of complacency. So, I mean, I'm sorry. I don't have anything against e-prescribing. I just think we have to recognize its limitations. I definitely like the 293, receiving a list of medications within 60 minutes, but I do want to point out there is a potential for an unintended consequence, which maybe we should think about with the balancing measure, which is if in an effort to get that 60-minute mark, we transfer incomplete information or information that's not accurate just so we can beat the clock, then we have set up another problem altogether. So, as I say, I apologize for being in a glass half empty mood today, but I think we have to be aware of some of these unintended consequences and maybe think about how we go about them. The last thing I want to say, and this is a little out of the box, maybe I should save it for the gaps. I'll save it for the gaps.
So before we go further, I want to welcome Laura Cranston. Laura is joining us at a very timely moment. As we're talking about adverse drugs, Laura, to my understanding, heads the Pharmacy Quality Alliance. So timing couldn't be better. Laura, thanks for joining us and welcome. And to the other, to Dana.
So, Richard, your remarks here, I think, very spot on and well shared by others. I actually participated on the Care Coordination Committee that reviewed for some of the same conversations of concern that we had as well, too. Heidi's shaking her head. And it's just like these measures individually each touch upon important components and issues that we're dealing with as related to medication reconciliation and adverse drug events, but they seem very fragmented still. And Heidi, one of the questions here maybe too on some of these, if I think there's some clarification needed in terms of care setting. Like Richard asked, I think on the 419, I believe that one is in the ambulatory setting, the physician's office, and not the inpatient setting. So I think that's something that would be helpful too for the members as they're here today, as they're reviewing these measures, that we need to understand what care setting that these measures are applying to. I do like measure 646 as related to a reconciled medication list being given to the patient. I think that's a pretty good measure. But again, Richard, as you said too, but it needs to be taken a step beyond that to make sure the patient understands this medication list and what they're supposed to be doing as well. As related to 293, that measure as well too, I can support. I think it's pretty much standard of practice today in terms of patients that are being transferred to inpatient facilities, to acute care hospitals, from long-term care, SNFs, you know, wherever home health, you know, the long-term care facilities, is that a current medication record is transferred with the patient. The 60 minutes, I'd like to say again that either the medication record was there in advance of the patient or with the patient. I don't know why quite the 60-minute gap, but I think what's important is that it does get there. So I'll stop my comments there.
Laura?
Frank, this is Tom James. I've got my card up.
Tom, I'll come to you in just a minute.
Okay.
I just have a few general comments, and one of them is about, and I agree with everything that's been said before, about the age. I think a lot of these measurements were developed at the age of when people over 65 usually were the ones that had a lot of medications going on. I think, especially with our SNP population, we're seeing a lot of lots of medications going on with comorbidities, diabetes and hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, ill, much earlier age. I'm talking 40s and 50s that we're seeing in the population today. So I think the measures, you know, as a whole, with the time these were developed, that really wasn't as much of an issue as it is today. The other thing is that I think timing is important. I was at a readmission conference with the Hospital Association of Southern California, and they were saying that these folks, that the hospitals are saying that these folks are getting readmitted within 72 hours of discharge. And so even waiting a week or 60 days or 30 days is just not cutting it anymore. They're coming in much, much earlier. And they do need appointments with the PCP. I see some of the measures talk about appointments with the PCP, which is another time to do this medication reconciliation. So I agree with the comments on the timing, that some of these may be inadequate in terms of the timing in order to see the PCP. The other issue is a lot of the patients are followed by hospitalists. And so, and the hospitals are to communicate with the PCP. So there's another communication gap that might be looked at in terms of medication reconciliation is between, and we hear that the hospital has ordered something that's different from what the PCP has ordered, if the patient knows who the PCP is. And sometimes that's not always the case either. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay. Amy?
If we're looking for things to call, I guess looking at measure 486, I don't want to say that e-prescribing is important, but from a patient safety perspective, can we say just the presence of having e-prescribing and using it necessarily makes care safer? Or is it kind of how you use it and how you implement it and kind of some of the safety checks that go with it? I'm not sure the measure really kind of goes far enough.
Tom, on the phone?
Yes, thank you. A couple of comments. Number one, just to echo the point coming from the dual eligibles work group, this was one of the issues that the age 65 we felt was not appropriate. We do need to have that moved down. Secondly, to Richard's point about people not understanding, this falls right in line with the health literacy issues that we discussed yesterday. And thirdly, is the issue that I'm disappointed is not in here, and that's that of polypharmacy. There is nothing that indicates that physicians need to call out the unnecessary medications. And certainly Alan Dobson with the people in Community Cares of North Carolina have found that by sending a pharmacist out to the home, that they've uncovered a polypharmacy beyond that which the prescribing physicians even recognize. Thank you.
I'm a little bit troubled by 646, and you've heard this mentioned before. We do a lot of work with transitional care, and a lot of the readmissions are related to patient reconciliation. And the problem is not that they did not get a sheet of discharge. They usually did, in fact, get a list of discharge. In fact, there have been changes. It may not, the hospitalists, as you've heard, may not have been the same as the PCP. But things have been changed. Doses have been changed. Sometimes a new medication has been added in the same category, and they're now taking both of them. The problem is that they call a physician. There's no appointments available for the next 3 or 4 weeks. You can't just hand a list to someone and get a signature on the way out the door. You have to actually go over the list with a patient or a responsible party, a caregiver, and make sure that the list is understood. They have the medications. They know what they're taking. They know how to take them. They know what has been discontinued. They know what dosages have been changed. And someone has to have the responsibility of going over that list. Without that, checking a box saying that you've handed someone a list and gotten a signature on that list creates a sense, creates the illusion that you have done something helpful when you probably have not.
Randy? I mean, Ron?
I like all of them on the discussion list except for the ones that I think I'm going to talk about. Number 486, which people have brought up. I'm actually 100% for e-prescribing. I use it every day. It's very valuable, but I don't think it necessarily needs to be on the list for some of the reasons that you said earlier. The 293 is one of those specialty ones and suffers from the limitation of the steward and the reason not being on the in the spreadsheet. It actually was an emergency department only. And so it's one of these ones that's written for when you're discharged specifically from an emergency department, make sure you have documentation in your chart of the medications that were communicated to the receiving, whatever the receiving place is. And I don't think we have to necessarily, I think that's duplicative with some of the other measures. I think that's one of the example that we talked about yesterday and today of steward put that in there so they could use it in their particular circumstance. But in this particular circumstance, I think some of the measures above that more commonly cover the same concept. And then 419, which we've also talked about, it actually is written even broadly also. So 419, which... still trying to decide. Yes, we mentioned earlier that that's clinic, but it's also home, hospital, SNF, it's that everybody in the world ought to have a medication list, regardless of your location. What?
There was a correct, they checked the wrong box.
Home hospital renamed.
It's everything
hospital,
but hospital.
Acute care facility. Yeah. So I'm not sure yet how I feel about 419. I mean, whether or not... It kind of falls in the category of, I don't know, yes, but does it really need to be a safety measure that we necessarily put on the list? So I would not include 486, 293, or 419.
Helen?
I'm really concerned about this list being sort of one big gap. It worries me that we're really not addressing the problems here. I think a list is fairly useless. The problem is patients being given the wrong medications, given medications that shouldn't go together, aren't appropriate for them. And I wonder if there's any sort of measure in existence that tries to get at that. And then other measures that I wonder about, is there one for narcotics overdose, in-hospital narcotics overdose in particular? And is there anything that asks if a pharmacist has checked the records? Is there any measure like that? It would seem to me that would be a real quality measure of something that we'd really want to encourage, that people's records are checked by pharmacists.
So I'm not sure what you're talking about with the pharmacist.
Well, just when you're talking about giving people a list upon discharge, would it not be better to have a pharmacist review their medications on discharge and make sure that their medications were appropriate? is that pie in the sky?
I'm not sure the pharmacist is the right person.
Really?
I don't know the pharmacist, but someone has to take the responsibility of reviewing the medication list and making sure it's understood and that they know what they're doing. Otherwise, you know, that would be just repeating the point again.
I mean, the hospital pharmacist is not the person doing the discharge. That's typically a nurse who's doing the discharge, and then those medications at discharge are going to an external pharmacy. So what role the external pharmacy could play is a good question.
I mean, if your concern is reconciling the hospital medications given in the hospital with the medications given at home, somebody's got to be looking at those besides the patient.
Yeah, well,
and it shouldn't wait for the first visit.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that when we look at home health care, they find a completely different pharmacy at home than the one at discharge. And there's no pharmacist at home. But when they go into the home and they open up the medicine cabinet, the patient has got a new list from the hospital, plus they have their old list. And a lot of patients don't know that you don't get to mix. And they feel like, well, here's my old meds I have to take, and then here's my new meds I have. And they take the entire pharmacopoeia, and they're back in the hospital with problems. So I think you're raising a good point that I'm not sure that we've considered as a gap area. I think you've also identified a great one on the wrong medication and the wrong dosage, whether or not it's narcotic. I think wrong dosage, too high or too low, regardless of the medication type, but then specifically for narcotics. I think those are all good gap areas, and those are all safety areas.
Well, I guess one of the things I was thinking about with narcotics also is that if you have a trigger, you know, just by you know, looking at the prescription for, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank, but the reversal agent, is that not something you could easily measure from the chart?
I mean, the use of reversal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's one. But you could have overdosage without the need to rescue. And you just let them come out of, you know, they're not at a point where you have to rescue them, but they still got overdosed. But those are all good potential measure opportunities. Bill?
Listening to this discussion and looking at the list, I'm struck by a couple of things. One is just to reiterate what some people have said, this is really a serious issue. It's clearly a safety issue. If our task, though, is to identify what measures should be used for public reporting and payment systems, I think we should be relying primarily on outcome measures. But as Helen said, this whole area looks like one big gap. You know, the existing measures that we're looking at here are almost all process measures. And most of them have some limitations, as we've been talking about. So we're stuck with this picking from a list of imperfect process and structure measures. So I suggest that we kind of radically prune this down and say, like, maybe just pick, if we're going to recommend from this list, just pick a couple that we think, you know, might be the most useful, like possibly 419 and 554, I think, the NCQA measure. And drop the others from public reporting and payment systems and focus on the gaps, the development of meaningful outcome measures. Now, the process measures are useful internally or could be useful for, you know, within hospitals, physicians, groups, home health, and nursing homes. But for public reporting, I think most of these are not very useful. And so where we ought to tee up, this is a big problem, there are gaps, let's get going on measure development. You know, wrong medication, wrong dosage with a significant medical effect. I'm not enough of a clinician to know exactly what those outcome measures should be, but from a layperson looking at this, I don't see any here. So that's where I recommend that we focus our efforts.
So still, I appreciate that, and I'm really falling back on what Helen had just drawn up as some good outcome measures of wrong medications, whether it's at home or, you know, in back in the physician's office or the hospital. There's an outcome measure that I don't know that we have. It's certainly not on our list. And the wrong dose is another outcome measure. So if there's others, if they come to mind in the discussion, please capture those because I think that's a great message. Richard?
One is, and this is an issue that SNF Alliance has been struggling with for a long time. We do an annual survey of our members, and we've been trying to zero in on identifying a specific adverse drug event measure. And unfortunately, we've ended up in the same place that I feel like we're here, and now we haven't found one. And so we end up kind of not collecting one of those all-encompassing measures as a result. But the kind of issues that our members talk about fit kind of in an outcome arena in terms of wrong drugs and wrong dose, drug interactions, people dropping the ball because of multi-prescribers, whether that's prescribers at the same time or prescribers in sequence to one another. Those are all places where I think, you know, we see lots of problems that get where there's a ball that gets dropped in terms of an adverse effect. But if I look at, you know, some of the things that we've talked about previously in terms of outcomes, I'm not sure even that's the outcome. You know, what's the result of a safety problem? If you have a decubitus ulcer, that's a problem. You know, then there's an intervention to resolve the problem. You want to sort out why that decubitus ulcer exists or why multiple decubitus ulcers exist. What's the problem? And then you look for the intervention that's related to that. These all seem like interventions related to a problem or different kind of problems, but they aren't defining the problem itself. I think we heard one problem earlier from Sean, and that was death. You know, there clearly are people die because of the wrong drug or because of a drug interaction or, you know, faulty treatment as it relates to medication. People also get confused and fall. You know, people, those are two of the more, I think, more major adverse effects that result from inappropriate management of drugs. And so it seems to me like in working towards, you know, filling the black hole here, it's a pretty big one. I would suggest we try to also push a little further here in terms of identifying the specific problems that result for the person, you know, as it relates to the drug medication management, and then back up in terms of looking at, you know, what is the variable that relates to that particular problem, and then what are the best practices for addressing that problem. And these appear to be kind of, for me, these are all best practices that haven't really been weighed relative to one another, but some of them seem to get at some of the issues more than others. And so 293, 554, I think, are a couple of, you know, those that do, it's upstream a ways, but it does help get at what some of the problems are. So I think we should pick some of those now, but put lots of emphasis to getting measures that really document the problem and then kind of what's related to the problem. Is it drug interaction? Is it miscommunication between multiple prescribers? Is it moving from, you know, one setting to another? Just from my own personal experience with my father, and we all seem to kind of learn from that experience almost more than other experiences, but every time my father, he died a couple of years ago, but every time he went into the hospital, his drug got changed, and he got confused. And confusion was the primary outcome as a result of the problem. And the only way that I could ever get it resolved was I had a geriatrician friend who would coach me in learning what all the drugs are, and then I would call the night nurse, and I would ask her what all the drugs were on its list, and then I would talk back to him, and he would say, what you really need to do is X, Y, and Z, and then I would tell the nurse, this is, I talked to my geriatrician friend, and this is what he suggested, and invariably, that nurse was able to kind of get some changes in what was going on, but most of the time, it related to a change in medication from moving from one setting to another, or multiple prescribers involved. Now, I'm not saying that's what's, you know, the case for most people. I think we've got to document that. I'm simply raising it as an illustrative example of where I think we need to focus in terms of identifying what's the problem, you know, with a major priority. But in the interim, I think we do need to kind of keep some of this going and not shut it down.
So being mindful of the end of the day, getting there, we need to start honing in on the measures at hand and the gaps. And so when I'm looking at and listening to your story, Richard, I pulled out of there, we've got real gaps in looking at adverse drug-related mortality. We've got gaps in adverse drug-related hospitalization and gaps in adverse drug-related elevation of care. So those are great additions to the gap list. And those are things we need to start putting into this so we can get this. Our safety list together for the adverse drugs.
Richard? The only one I would add to that is death. You know, I think we...
Why I put adverse drug-related mortality.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, great. Anne-Marie?
A couple of things. I think I agree with a lot of what's been said. Just one point on the pharmacist issue. I don't think it's ready for a measure, but there's a lot of literature now that the best people for reconciling medications with patients are actually pharmacists who talk to patients, and that a lot of people working in trying to deal with the very complex patients like CHF discharges, and I know in our hospital now we put a pharmacist on that team. So I'm just saying that they are really great. I'm not saying we're ready for a measure, but they are an important piece of the team. Two things on the measures. I think that I agree that we should pick a couple of these because some they're really not very good, but the only one I would include, I mean, you measured two. The only one I wouldn't let go of is that 646, that even though it's grossly inadequate that you just give a patient a list, there's still not compliance across the country that every patient gets a list. So I would just not let that one go. I think the patients at least have to walk out with that list. And then you need to have, I think, 646, 554, and probably 419, but I'm suspicious that 419 just means that you've got a list of medicines in the chart. And I don't know how effective that is, so I almost might drop that one and just go for 646 and 554. And then in terms of the gaps, and while it's still a process indicator, I think something that might ultimately measure that within real time, in real time I'm talking like 72 hours, maybe there's an actual communication between the physician at one level of care to the handoff to the physician at the next level of care. That could be a fax, that could be an electronic record, that could be a telephone call if you have to, but some kind of measure that demands that people act, that the caretakers actually communicate in real time, not 30 days, not 60 days, but real time, and I think probably 72 hours, maybe 2 or 3 days, something like that. And while it's still a process measure, I think it might move the system to just ensure that that communication would actually happen, because we give patients lists and expect them to give the list to the next person who understands how to reconcile. So that real-time communication, that's a gap. That's something that maybe as a creative measure would help move the system a bit.
So I'm getting mixed reviews on lists. We like lists, but lists aren't good enough. That's kind of what I'm hearing, that having a patient just take a list and sign off on the list doesn't help the patient. It helps somebody just check a box. But it made them think about checking the box. So there's people like the list, but I'm not so sure that people like what it's doing for the patients. That's kind of what I'm hearing. So I'm hearing a gap in there. We could accept LIST, but, boy, we'd really like to see something beyond LIST because we don't think it's getting the outcome we want. And
I might say if it's just going to be the LIST, I think the LIST has to mean that someone actually did the discussion. When you hand someone the LIST on the way out the door, that means that you are whoever is doing it is certifying that a discussion occurred with a patient or a responsible family manager, and they understand their medications.
I heard that, Randy, but what I also heard was that's not good enough. I can have a conversation with a patient. That doesn't mean the patient got it. So, I mean, it's the patient end of this that we haven't completed. We can complete the provider end in multiple different ways, but if it isn't coming back from the patient, we've got a safety issue. That was what I heard.
Well, I would say that it doesn't complete the provider end either. I mean, that was my point, that there's nothing about giving a list that says these are medications that should be on the list. But
when a clerk hands it to someone out the door, on the way out the door, it's just not helpful. It doesn't mean that any conversations took place, really.
No, I'm watching this in real time, and it's pretty disappointing. I'm seeing patients get all kinds of things to sign. They all sign them because otherwise they don't get their meds, but they have no idea what they're doing, none at all. And it happens every day. But everyone gets to check their box. We did it. Patient signed off on it. And the pharmacist always asks, do you have any questions? And they're done. And the patient's got this long list of everything that drug can do, and they're totally confused. Nancy?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. So on the list, this does, in 646, it does state a reconciled medication list. So by that verbiage, that, you know, the intent is this has been reconciled by physician, pharmacist, the policy is for that organization, but the patient is given a reconciled list. Still not perfect, but I think it's a step further than just a list. And there's still the issues, again, too, that, yes, teaching, quote-unquote teaching, occurs with the patient, but how much do they really comprehend and understand? Still, yes, is, I think, is a gap.
Nancy?
Thanks, Frank. And I join in the chorus that says this is an imperfect list of choices for us. It's in part because medication is probably the most common therapy we give. We give it most patients multiple medications in any setting you're in. And so there are a variety of causes of errors, a variety of repercussions that occur. This, trying to solve this is a little bit like boiling the ocean. And I think that we're going to have to get to a point for patients and for the clinicians involved where we identify sort of what are the three big bets here? What are the things we're going to push that will move the dial? We won't get to zero yet. We're not anywhere near that. But what are the three things we're going to bet on right now? And what do we want to develop so we can have the next round of improvements happen so that we can get really take significant steps in alleviating some of the problems here. And as I look at this list, I don't think it's even adequate for that task to have three big things, two big things where we're going to really move the dial. And that's my struggle with this particular list is, you know, giving somebody a reconciled list, great idea, absolutely has to happen. Do I think it's going to move the dial? No. And I don't know how to help us there, to tell you the truth, because I think most of these measures don't get us anywhere near where we want to go. And so to me we're you know, choosing from among a really poor set of options. That said, the one measure that I think I would call out and propose we think about a little differently is 293, which was developed, I know, by the University of Minnesota as part of an effort to help assess what should those small rural hospitals be doing to affect safe transfers of patients when they needed a more aggressive type of care than could be offered in those hospitals. So while I realize this is related to medication, to me it's really part of a different set of activities than medication safety, if you will. And I don't know if we're dealing with safe transfers or if that's the care coordination group, but to me this fits more with that.
So, and again, your comments are very much in line with what Bill had brought up and with what Helen had brought up and a little bit of what Richard had brought up, that we're all focused on the gaps, and I think we've had a great gap discussion, and I think we can extract a lot from the gaps. The question is, on this list, is there anything you want? And when I look at everyone's comments, it looks like the whole list. Everyone has one or two favorites, and that we've not gotten a consensus on anything. So which tells me it's all or nothing, the way we're currently going. So I need a little direction from you about the first message we have is we don't like any of this. But not liking any of it, I'll take this one. And by the time we're done, we have them all. And our wish list is a really great list of some highly well-thought-out gaps that are going to be tough measures to design, but we can send that message. So think about that as we're looking at this list. Do we want to send a message of more of these, or really do we want to get it narrow? And otherwise, I think I've got most of your gaps. If there's a gap missing, bring it up. But then otherwise, focus on what we have, because I'm not sure I know where we're going right now. We're all or nothing, and I'm somewhere lost. Laura, you're going to straighten us out.
I don't know if I'll straighten you out, but in terms of the gaps, there's three measures that I think are missing. There's a high-risk medications measure that's an NQF-endorsed measure that was recently updated painstakingly through the American Geriatric Society, and so we've modified our measure to meet their recommendations. That is a measure currently used in the CMS Star Ratings Program for Medicare Part D, which is actually tied to performance through the quality bonus payment. So that's already a measure that's in a pay-for-performance type of system. So I would recommend taking a look at that measure. PQA and NCQA developed that measure together. There's a second gap that there exists a measure for, and that is drug-drug interactions. And so PQA has an endorsed measure on the most significant drug-drug interactions to be avoided. That's a measure that I think should be looked at in terms of safety. And then there is also a measure that CMS will begin using in 2013, and it is a comprehensive medication review, CMR, comprehensive medication review measure, also endorsed by PQA and will be used in the Medicare population. And so what CMS has done is they've identified the patients that are on X number of meds and hit a certain drug spend a year. Those patients qualify for a comprehensive medication review annually with a kind of a second review that could also be done during the year. And they will begin to use that measure in 2013. So
for what program?
Medicare Part D and, yeah.
So when you say these are endorsed, are those NQF? You said drug.
The high-risk meds measure is an NQF-endorsed measure developed by NCQA and PQA. The drug-drug interaction is a PQA-endorsed measure currently used by CMS in the STAR ratings program. And the comprehensive medication review measure is a measure that CMS has announced they will begin using in 2013.
But neither of those are NQF-endorsed.
The drug-drug interaction measure is not, and the comprehensive medication review is not. CMS uses measures that are PQA-endorsed as well as NQF-endorsed.
Do you know if those are able to be NQF-endorsed?
they're able to be NQF endorsed. They're kind of a niche, you know, so we always are subject to waiting for a call for measures in that particular area. So in all reality, I think it's such a niche, Frank, that I'm not sure that there'll be a call for those type of measures to be endorsed. And that is why CMS has chosen to use it if it makes its way through the PQA endorsement process.
Okay. Thanks so much. Dan? Sorry, you've been patiently waiting, but we're getting around the table.
No problem. I just, since I work for HRSA's Office of Rural Health Policy, I just wanted to echo Nancy's point about 293. And I know the folks at the Minnesota Rural Health Research Center, and I haven't talked to them specifically about this, but I do believe that the spirit of this was written for our critical access hospitals, which are, again, small rural hospitals, no more than 25 beds, no more than 4 days of service, and often, again, either from the acute care setting or from the ED, the patients indeed are transferred, and I think it was intended to help with the quality focus of the critical access hospitals in terms of for the receiving hospitals to have adequate information about medication.
Thank you. Barbara?
Yeah, I just want to make a plea for not dropping everything, not dropping the good in search of the better, or whatever the expression is, that I think there's consensus around one of the reconciliation measures and one of the list measures. And I think we should insist on at least those two, as well as a very strong statement about GAP.
Thank you. And I'm just trying to figure out which one. And if anyone has a clue, I'll take it. Andrea?
I'm going to take the opposite tack on this. When I look at this mess, it's a mess. It hasn't gotten us anywhere so far, and I don't think regulating these lists is going to make people do a better job of taking care of patients. And I see how these lists play out in daily lives, and I see the energy that goes into making sure the list is there so the box can get checked, and I don't think it's going to move the dial. So I think if we really want to do the right thing for patient safety, we would get rid of all this and put our energies into making sure people are doing innovative things around this, and even possibly, moving to structural measures and looking for things that say, are you working on this? Do you have a process for this, as opposed to, here's the process, we're defining it for you, and we don't even know that you can, that it matters. We've shown now for years that you can give to those heart failure discharge instructions or the heart failure med rec metric, and that people can just check the box and not necessarily do a great job on those things. So I'm not necessarily in favor of any of these, although I will say that I do think that the e-prescribing, to my mind, pediatric place is the single most important thing that we can do right now around some of the med errors, whether that needs to be a metric or not. I'm not so clear, but anyway, so I'm going to take the opposite tack from Barbara.
Great. Andrea?
And I go by Andrea, so that way maybe that's a distinction I can go by. To answer your question, Frank, I think starting with the major, this is all just a major gap, but of this, what would we select? I'd agree with Bill. 419 and 554 would be the two to select. And I want to echo the comment around the drug-to-drug PQA endorsed measure. I don't know if that's the one I mentioned at the beginning, which is the drug-to-drug-to-drug allergy interaction check. That's not if it's different. But there, while that is a process measure, the one that at least is listed in the spreadsheet, or it's not listed as a process measure, but it's described as such, I think if physicians are implementing drug-to-drug or drug-to-allergy interaction checks, that would lead to positive outcomes or could lead to an outcome even though it appears process. So, thank you.
Sean?
I'm a glass half full person this morning, Richard. And I,
You know, I just wanted to highlight, I do think we need to do something on this. I agree with Liz, but I would argue again for 419, again with the and statement that Dan verified. I agree with 554. There's an and statement, we're reconciled. So it's not just about Liz. It's actually recommending that something little, and whether that gets implemented or not, I agree with you, Frank. It could be a checkbox, but it's a start. 293A, again, you know, Nancy sold me on that. And then I guess I don't want us to lose sight of 176, which is the only outcome measure on the list, which I think we're forgetting about because it's on the page beforehand. But it is the only outcome measure that actually looks at our patients appropriately taking their medications, and I don't want to lose sight of that one.
Could I, in your initial remarks, you asked a question about that one as a bundle, not a composite, but a bundle.
Yeah, I asked because it seemed to link up with 520, which was, instructions on monitoring, but the people around the table have sort of convinced me that just documenting instruction is probably not worth it. And actually the real measure is whether people are taking their medications correctly. And I actually think that if you do 176, then 520 becomes irrelevant. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Heidi, are those intended to be reported together?
They're not paired in any way, but just because I went in and sometimes the title and the description doesn't give you all the information you need. I went in and let me just tell you what the two look at. They're the same patient population. There's nothing different. 176 looks at the time of discharge, is there less impairment in taking oral medication? And then 520 looks at the end of the at discharge, was the patient instructed on how to effectively monitor the effectiveness of the drug therapy, recognize potential adverse effects, and how and when to report problems. So those are the two. They're not paired at this point. So.
Okay. So we've got still some cards up, but what I'm hearing is 554, 419, 293, 646, and 176. I'll give you a minute on that.
Can
454, 419, 293, 646, and 176. And an update.
I waited till the end because I wanted to see where you ended up. So I want you to be aware that measure 419 is being looked at or will be looked at by the CSAC in July against 553 because they appear to be competing measures. So just be aware there is the potential that both measures could have continued endorsement. If possible, one will be considered superior to the other. So we can, I just wanted you to be aware of that issue. They do, really do measure the same thing. 553, I'm pretty sure it's 553. It's not on there, it's on your spreadsheet. And 553, I had it up. It's percentage of adults 65 years and older who had a medication review. So when you look at the actual.
419 is 18. And older.
Right, so that's some of the issues that the Frank and everyone else at the CSAC will get to deal with. Dana, I know, reviewed 553 in the care coordination project. 419, unfortunately, was in the safety project. We didn't get it sorted. So
Heidi, can you confirm, it's 419 in the physician office setting and 293, is that in the ED setting?
So 293 is ED transfers out to an adult acute care facility.
Okay.
419 is non-hospital, all of
it. Yeah, so it's clinician reporting, and any point in time you have a visit with that patient, you are reporting whether you've reviewed the medication.
Helen?
I was having
some general comments. I wanted to say that I think we need to keep it as small as possible, two or three measures, and not divert energies into the process measure. And In terms of, you know, gaps in outcome measures, I just want to throw out that I think, you know, from the patient perspective, what we hear is that the, really one of the biggest problems, not the biggest problem that they face, is providers not recognizing medication side effects. And I don't know if there's any way to get at that, to do something that would sort of, you know, help raise awareness of providers on that issue, but that's just something I wanted to put on the table.
And I've got in our gap area, Helen, the PQAs, drug-drug interaction. We don't have it as a measure in the NQF, but we certainly could look at it as a gap to see if we could push it through endorsement.
Those three measures sounded great.
I looked at the comprehensive med review to answer Tom James's question about polypharmacy, and thought that was a good gap coverage for that, that we could actually push that one to seek endorsement. We're still trying to find the high-risk medication endorsed measure. Oh.
It should be measure 22. It's use of high-risk medications in the elderly, which is based on the Beers criteria, is that one. Recently updated, and NCQA is updating the measures and fees. Yep.
I'm putting that on our list as well and seeing if that's something you want to comment on. So we've got the list I've given you, a big list of gaps, and add to the list measure 22, this high-risk medication. Okay? Richard?
Yeah, I while we have a big problem here, I think this is probably our best next step as I think about it. I mean, when I look at the four measures you have on the initial list here, it's assuming that there's problems going in and out of the hospital. Well, there's one of these measures that's going into the hospital, one that's at the point of hospital discharge, and one that's 30 days post-hospital discharge. I think that's a nice combination of measures there. 419 provides, I think, a nice baseline for looking at these issues, you know, in a general setting. And then the three, you know, I like the high-risk measure. It seems to me like the drug interaction and comprehensive medication review should also be looked at, you know, in terms of the next steps when thinking about three, you know, buckets here, the four measures, then looking at these next three, and then underline multiple times and put on neon lights the importance of getting out outcomes and documentation, getting some measures in terms of what the real problem is. It feels to me like this is where the best we can do at this time. I do have a question about warfarin. We've got four measures there. I don't know whether there's one measure that
For now, let's stay within this framework and then
fine.
We'll go to those because I think we're in a good place right now in how we're moving, and then we can get to these selective adverse drug events when we get to warfarin because it's kind of just a different can of worms that will open. But we will come back to it. Nancy?
So, Frank, let me express what I admit is a prejudice, which is I am concerned about the high-risk medication one in the elderly because we cannot get to the kind of commonality in measurement and usefulness across the patient population unless we stop having things specified for a specific age group unless there's a clinical reason to specify them for that age group. We got lots of kids on polypharmacy now. We got, you know, lots of younger adults that we were talking about before on polypharmacy, and I think it defeats the purpose of this activity to have it specified for the Medicare population and not useful to the other populations. So use it now if we have to, but we got to push ourselves.
Good measure, but a gap.
Yeah.
Okay. Barbara?
I don't want to interrupt the flow. I want to reserve a comment for the end of the discussion.
Okay. Richard? Somebody had to interrupt the flow. Mike?
I'm troubled by building a long list of imperfect things. What we recommend then can become part of public reporting and payment, which really drives behavior and energy. So I understand these can be sort of way stations. A list can be a way station on the way to a more effective interaction. But if we say we want to ensure that lists are given, then lists will be given. People will invest their energies in checking that box, and I think it's counterproductive. I think what we really need, we know what we need, we want to understand outcomes. We want to understand how many patients were harmed because their medications, well, they didn't understand how to take their medication. Now, how we get there, we can think about that. There may be ways to do that, but, you know, checking the list box is not one of them. So I don't agree with building up a long list. I do, the only thing, the one that I do feel has merit is the 293, which is making sure that there was documentation sent within 60 minutes. Because that's a real thing that can be, that can possibly result in a better result. The others, I'm not sure will have that effect.
Lost my flow. All right, Barbara.
Thank you. I'm back again to thinking about what are we doing with family and core. What are family measures and what are core measures, and how do we decide? The family's easy because the staff has laid out the names of the families, you know, Smith, Jones, medications, whatever. But I don't know, how do we select, after all this discussion where we have multiple measures in every family, how do we end up with a core set? And let me argue very strenuously against voting online for a core set, because I really think the discussion is key to coming to consensus.
So our family is safety, and the subtopic we have is in here is our adverse drug events, and the core set is the core set that goes across the continuum. So if we got something for ambulatory, if we got something for hospital-based, if we got home health care, And from these measures, we're building that core set within adverse drug events within the safety umbrella. And I mean, we've raised incredible points about gaps, and I think we all have a very respectful level of discomfort with the measures that we have, but only because we think there's so much opportunity left out there. And it's not a heavy lift to get there. It's just somebody's got to start doing the measure development.
Presumably, we're going to have, let me ask then, are we looking to have one or two measures per setting? Or what's our outcome?
We're not trying to say there is a setting, a measure per setting. We would love to know that. We have one for every setting, but we may not. We may say the measures that are there are good quality measures. They may be good patient experience of care measures, but there's not a safety measure in that setting. But if there is and you like it, then this is the time to elevate it to the family and say that we think this is a safety measure. We think it's a good place to start. It may not be perfect, or we don't think it's a good place to start, and we don't want to select it. So you know, we would love to know there's one for every single setting, but we may not have one for every setting. There may be minimal adverse drug events in a particular setting based on safety, and it may just not be something that anyone's paid attention to in measure development. We would identify that as a gap. And believe me, you guys have created a monster gap list here. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you, sir. I'm late. I was meaning to be here yesterday and just couldn't pull away. A comment I would make about choosing families, I'm Kevin Larson from the Office of National Coordinator and work on quality measures for the Meaningful Youth Program. When we've been talking to the VA, one of the ways the VA has done some of the measures around safety is they find a measure that they know correlates with other things. So they actually, we've been talking with them about their adverse drug event warfarin monitoring measures. They have a suite of about four measures, but they only pick one of them, because they know that if people do well on that one, they also do well on the other four, and they've actually validated that within the VA. They know that if people do poorly on that one, they also do poorly on the other four. So instead of overcomplicating the measurement landscape for at least in their choice, they've picked the one that's most straightforward to measure, measures a majority of the population, but also is predictive of a good care in other settings.
So right now, let me ask if there's any comments from the members on the phone.
No comments. Thanks, Rick.
And let me open for a public comment in the room. Please identify yourself and your affiliation, and we'd love to hear from you.
Lisa Brooks Taylor from the American Health Information Management Association, and I'd like to second Andrea's comment regarding the e-prescribing, having an e-prescribing measure. I would be embarrassed to tell you how many times I sat working late hours in a health information services department and watched my staff field phone calls from retail pharmacists at 10 o'clock at night because they cannot read the script that the family member just brought in because mama just got discharged from the hospital. We need these meds. So I urge an e-prescribing measure.
Any other public comment in the room? And open the phone lines for public comments.
Okay, to make a comment, please press star, then your number one. And there are no comments from the phone line.
All right. Thank you very much. I really think, let me just summarize where I think we are, and then I think we're going to take a break. And we'll kind of gather our thoughts in the break, and we'll come back and look at the warfarin specifically. What I've got on the list is the measures I called out before, 554, 419, 293, 646, 176, measure 22, and this 486, which was the e-prescribing structure measure. Let's take a break and think about this in the break, and then we'll come back. We'll revisit the list one more time, and we'll go from there into so 10 minutes. Thank you very much. All right, let's see where you are on a break. You've cleared your heads, and you've actually tried to get some nutrition on board, hopefully in the break. We generated a list, and I'm just wondering if this isn't the list to move forward, and wondering if you want to pull something from it or add something to it. That was that list. So we had talked about 554, 419, 293, 646, 176, 22, and 486. Richard?
Yeah, I'd just like to speak towards moving forward with the list. You know, it seems to me like this is, it's perhaps the most important safety issue here. It may be the place where there's the biggest gap, and it's important for us, given the safety issue, to not, from my perspective, kind of stop things from things that we know were important but not perfect, you know, to shut any of that down. I think it's important for us to reinforce some measures for problems that we know exist and where they exist, and keep the ball rolling on that, and then look at putting most of
the energy of National Quality Forum into, you know, getting focused on the outcome, but where there's some endorsement of a family of measure that reflects this set of priorities. So,
super. Thank you. Any other comments? Richard?
I guess my comment is we are saying that, that these measures are somehow suitable and desirable for public reporting and possibly for payment. And that's because this is the applications group. So I, but and I'm not so sure. I agree these things may be useful to measure in the hope of getting us where we need to be. But I just want us to question, do we really want to state that these are all now suitable for public reporting because they're really going to get us, they're going to move us in the right direction.
Nancy?
I agree with Richard. I'm not sure these are going to get us anywhere, and I really am hesitant to push them very far into most of the public programs. And I also wanted to say that, at least for me, knowing that some of these are coming up at the CSAC, as Heidi has indicated to us, that I would, since we have not done a deep dive on the measures, to comment on their construction, if the CSAC in its wisdom thought they were inappropriate or needed to be removed from endorsement, I would hope that we would follow suit.
Bill?
I share Richard and Nancy's discomfort with these, but I also don't feel comfortable with having no measures. So my first preference would be two or three measures, and again, I'll reiterate my support for 419 and 554 if we're going to pick two. And I might add number 22, the drug-drug interaction that Laura described earlier. I'm not as familiar with that, but that sounds like it might be possible, even though it's limited its application to 65 plus. My second choice would be to go with all six that you suggested, but maybe there's with a big asterisk to say we believe these are imperfect, and we are focused on developing true outcome measures to fill that gap. Maybe even put a sunset on our recommendations that, you know, we recommend these for public reporting for 24 months or something like that, and then it gets dropped. I think the third best, my third fallback would be to do none of the above, and I think to do nothing in this area would be worse than either of the first two options. So first choice, two or three measures, second choice, six measures, third choice, no.
So, Bill, how did you come to not want the outcome measure?
Oh, I'm sorry.
And not want to measure the ED transfer measure?
Oh, it's just agonizing. I don't know.
That's our problem. I mean,
yeah, I know. I'm just, there's good arguments for and against all of these.
Right.
And it has to do with the, 176 is, a limited, you apply just to home health. What was the other one you mentioned?
It was the transfer, the ED transfer medication.
Also seems to be, limited. I don't know. The reason I like 554 is it has broader application in terms of it appears to be, even though I understand, I've been mixing together the level of analysis with the care setting, but it appears to be applied more broadly. So that's why I lean toward measures that have broader application rather than just in the limited care setting.
One other observation I'm making just watching our dialogue is that this area is an area in which around the table, the level of expertise is extremely high, and the expectations are high, and therefore you've got this incredible gap list of where we should go, and it makes it more difficult to look at what you do have when you feel it's so inadequate compared to where you'd think we could be relatively soon. So it makes it much more challenging to get to consensus, and I'm just hearing we're short of consensus here, and it may be we've got a list we couldn't reach consensus on because we think there's so much opportunity in the gap. But I'm just listening to you, and I'm amazed at your level of expertise and your frustration with these measures. So, Dana?
So I stand in a similar position as Richard and Nancy, and it feels like a bitter pill that I think we're trying to swallow here. But in the spirit of trying to achieve some consensus, I could live with the measures that you have mentioned, Frank, and with the exception of 554, and that really one disturbs me in that up to, given that reconciliation that occurs within 30 days of discharge, when we know that is a very critical patient, critical time period for patients where there's often commonly readmissions into the hospital, and that, there can be adverse drug events or conflicts during that time. So that bothers me as related to that time period. Probably the two of the that you put before us here, Frank, that we've discussed that I'm probably most comfortable with would be 176 and then 293, and possibly the ones that Laura has mentioned, but, we haven't had those in front of us really thoroughly reviewed.
Amy?
I actually have a measure clarification question, which I think relates to what she was discussing. If I'm reading 554 correctly, this is a health plan evaluation measure. And I would expect that medication reconciliation is taking place through a care manager or a nurse manager of some kind at the health plan. In that case, that 30-day delay kind of makes sense. It's, at a healthcare facility, we would obviously expect it to happen much more quickly. But I think from a purchaser perspective, that can be kind of helpful if you're looking at purchasing through a health plan and you're looking for their care coordination of a patient. I wasn't sure we were capturing that distinction.
Heidi, have you got the
I think it's a medical record review that's done at the physician level. I'm pulling it up to make sure I have it right.
Medical record review at the physician level. So they'll pull medical records for that from our physicians and then do a medical record review to see that the physician did it from our medical record.
Well, if that's the case, I would rescind my concern then.
Laura?
I was just curious. I thought that was a very creative solution, Bill, and I was wondering if we're allowed to do that. In other words, adopt this small set of measures for a period and then have them sunset with the understanding that in that 24-month window, we're looking for better intermediate outcome measures or outcomes measures. Can you do that?
Put that all along and all that is happening.
We have time-limited applications.
Well,
that's a new term to me.
Yeah, No, not officially, shall I say, but the sense of the group has been in all of these categories that we don't have what's adequate. We could set what we think would be an appropriate time,
my understanding is this is a year-to-year program, and
yeah.
It's a 12-month endorsement, basically. It's time-limited because we're going to have to relook at these or at CMS's request. So, I mean, they're all – these measures are basically 12-month measures. Mm-hmm. So we're expanding it to 24 months. But my understanding is the time limited is, it's a 12-month cycle, and if CMS wants to review it, it goes up on the list. And if our message is we were deeply concerned about this and there are gaps, I couldn't – and somebody stimulated the closure of the gaps, I couldn't believe these measures would survive very long. Sean?
Let me take a stab at getting this a little closer. First of all, I think the two-year window is important because of all the gaps were identified. The second is I hear your concerns, Richard and Nancy, about these being linked to payment, and I would share them if I didn't know the data and in practice know that just getting docs to make a list of what people are on is still – we can't do that yet. I mean, physicians' offices still don't have realistic lists of what their patients are on. And you can't begin to look at drug-drug interactions. You can't begin to do adequate prescribing unless you get an. And this gets us to that stage. Would I be really comfortable if 5-6 years down the line we were still having these, you know, linking these to payment? Absolutely not. But if we could use these to get a change in behavior so we can get to the next step, and we put in a clause to make it 2 or 3 years or whatever we think it is, I'm okay with that because I think we've got to at least get to that step. You know, it is really bad out there. And the data, every time we do another study, we see it. And this at least will get us to an accurate recording, which I think is a preliminary. It's a necessary but not sufficient in addressing this. And I hear what you're saying about payments, but not long term.
At this point, I think our message is we have this list, and I'm not convinced we have consensus. We narrowed down the scope to a list that we thought closely came to our minimum standards, but we couldn't quite get there on consensus. And so we can deliver this list to the Measures Application Partnership Reporting Committee, but really with the caveat that we struggled to get consensus for various reasons, and all well stated. And then I think our real statement will be in the gaps and a big push in the gap areas. Bill?
I just offer just a slight nuanced or hopefully friendly amendment. Seems like most of us feel there should be some measures, that the current measures are inadequate. And if we go, the way I would characterize the list of the 6 measures that you had put forward.
Rep is 7.
Okay. There's nobody that thinks all 7 are great, but that of these, out of the, I don't know, 10 or 14 measures, these are the ones that we're all circling around. Some people have some concerns about this. If we had to pick 2 or 3, that's where there's not consensus. But I think there's a low bar consensus, or at least around the 6. On measures we don't feel comfortable with, those are the ones that kind of are in the top tier rather than the bottom tier. So it's not a complete lack of consensus. There is we couldn't get from the 6 down.
I mean, hearing no objection, we can frame it that way. Okay. Warfarin. And thank you, Bill. So warfarin, there are 4 measures. Now we're actually very selective, and so we've moved away from the broader view and kind of in the spirit of what Kevin added, I'm wondering, you know, is there 1 or are there 2 out of these 4, or do we need all 4, or do we need any? I would note we do have a gap identified specific to warfarin, and that was a drug-drug interaction gap that I think Tom James pointed out earlier. Kevin?
A couple of comments from the work that we're doing at the ONC with the Meaningful Use Program. There, in the proposed rule, there's an adverse drug event measure, and that has settled on warfarin as the adverse drug event for monitoring. So we spent quite a bit of time looking at this measure set to figure out what could be e-specified, which is the word for making these work in the electronic world. And we actually invested a fair bit of time and energy in 555, and we're actually unable to technically e-specify that measure as it was NQF endorsed. So we are not including that one in our in the proposed rule or in the meaningful use program because it was technically not able to be specified and maintain the kind of integrity of the measure.
Mike, were any of these listed specified?
So we looked to the VA, actually, and it's really the VA measure that we focused on for our work with the Meaningful Use Program because they developed a measure from an electronic health record. And so it was much more amenable to other programs leveraging the electronic health record. These measures largely looked at claims. And the challenge we had in e-specifying for electronic health record program is that these required information across settings that payers have that providers at the point of care typically don't have, and so they aren't really amenable to a provider-oriented measurement.
Richard, did you have another?
I do. So that's very useful to know because I think you're right. Some of these things do need to come from data that spans the continuum of care, and we're not quite there yet. But I think the closest we come maybe might be to the claims data. And I do think 555 seems like a decent measure in that we do want to make sure patients who are on warfarin are continually being monitored. So that seems like an adequate measure. And on the 556 addresses a particular problem, which is checking the monitoring the INR after starting antibiotics. So that seems to me also not duplicative and also useful. The next one seems to be subsumed in 555 because you would know that if as part of the measure, and it seems to me 612 is very poorly specified. So I like the first two.
Thank you. Is that Dana?
Yeah.
So I was looking at actually 612 as possibly being a measure that would have a, you know, again, a broad reach across the care continuum. And, I mean, we don't have the specifications of this measure here. I would imagine there's more detail behind it. But that, I would think, would be a measure, 612, too, worth considering.
I have it if you'd like to know what it is. So denominator is patients with the current refill for warfarin, and the numerator is just anyone who had PT INR monitoring in that time period. So once they see a refill, they look to see. It's not clear, and I think I'll have to go back to the original specification to see what time period they look for the monitoring. That's the part that's not in what I've got and I pulled off.
Andrea?
So my only comment is that we don't have a recommendation on which of these has more value than the other, but to your question about should a medication-specific measure be included in the family, I would say yes, given the volume of the patients that are on these medications, and they have very specific contraindications. So I would say yes, include in the family, but defer to others on the appropriate measure.
So right now I'm looking at really the first two kind of as a bundle. Does that sound like a reasonable place to land for this measure set? And gaps in this measure, other than we mentioned the adverse events related to warfarin and the medication errors related to warfarin. Nancy?
To your question, Frank, I'm not sure that we should focus on gaps in warfarin as much as there are other high-risk medications that have particular challenges. A lot of the chemotherapy, cancer drugs, and so forth have very high risk to them. And so maybe if we should encourage a sort of look at some of those very high-risk drugs that have very specific
So the gap being we should establish the high-risk medications and the gaps related to high-risk medications.
That would be my preference.
Okay, great. Dana, is your card still up? Lance?
I guess I would add to that, and I might recommend that we actually look at this list right here for areas where there are gaps. I'm not a clinician, but I believe the warfarin pertains to number two. Is that correct, Wagelin? So right there are major gaps. And this comes from ARC's study using the Medicare Patient Safety Monitoring System. So they're doing claims, or actually medical record reviews, if I'm not mistaken, of Medicare claims data, I believe. So this kind of lays out the case here of what we're missing. And I think this pretty much goes along the lines of what we've seen, you know, in regards to, you know, this being a common event, and also, you know, those are the areas that I think we've seen in the literature in the past, whether it be, you know, the Two Errors Human Report, other literature studies that go back to 1964 that actually point out that some of these that are showing up now as problems have been a problem for a very long time. So I think we ought to target or use, you know, this list as a starting place as a target for gaps that are specific to different conditions.
Great. Thank you. Helen?
I think that's a good idea, although I'm interested in this. I believe it's a very different frequency from the MedMarks data. Which is what people report, I think, as opposed to you saying this was extracted from the charts. So that's just sort of food for thought. But my concern, if we're going to have measures that are specifically aimed at warfarin, then I think we should have an adverse reaction measure specifically aimed at warfarin. And my question is, doesn't one exist? I would think there would be one.
We'd have to look on our large list. I don't have any problems.
Okay. Well,
but
anyway.
We'll look at that.
Yeah.
And if it's not, we'll identify that as a gap. Amy?
This is actually not chart abstracted. This is from the nationwide inpatient sample and the nationwide emergency department sample.
The list we're looking at.
Yep.
Okay. Ron?
So once again, it's hard to be against monitoring for people that are on warfarin, given that earlier yesterday we identified DVT-MP as very high priority. But these are each written sloppily in their own manner, and by themselves, 555, and I understand why it's almost impossible to develop e-specs for 555. It's written so sloppily. I mean, think of that average percentage of monthly intervals in which individuals with claims for warfarin do not receive an INR test during the measurement period. I get the concept behind it. It's just the English is so crude. It's hard to really support a statement like that. 556 also, again, has the limitation is, if you just got started on any of the one of the multiple medications that could interact with warfarin, do you have an INR adjustment made within 3 to 7 days? Not a bad concept. Again, trying to manage that, I can't imagine how real time that could be done. It's not a bad concept, but again, doesn't deal with warfarin management in general, deals with the subset who get different medications started along with their warfarin, and so doesn't tackle the bigger problem. 586 is, again, you just had to have at least one INR test done after the first warfarin prescription in the measurement year, and that doesn't deal with the long-term management of warfarin either. Technically, you could meet that just ordering one test done 7 days later or 30 days later. So when I looked at those, the one, 612 is the simplest written one. I went to the measure, and the measure's written simply also. But, I mean, it is the one who says what the point is the clearest. There's a lot of details behind it we don't know, but says if you're on warfarin, are you then monitored for it? You know, and
I have the time window, too, if you'd like that.
What?
4 months. The time window
four months.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of the best of a bunch of bad world here, 612 is the one that comes the closest to covering the broad population for the longest period of time across many settings to at least say, are you getting monitored for your warfarin? But this is another very bad group of measures for what should be a pretty simple concept. You're taking a blood thinner, are people watching out for it?
Lance, are you in the queue?
Yeah, the other item I wanted to mention is, I guess, a limitation and maybe a gap here, is that when I look at these, they're all process measures. Some of these, to me, look like they're check-the-box type measures. So I think a gap here is we're missing an intermediate outcome or outcome-type measure within this group. And that comes to light in our experiences with the HEN program. And that we're having to choose one process measure, one outcome measure for hospitals to measure within the HEN program. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the outcome or intermediate outcome measures that we're looking at is a percent of patients that have an INR value of less than 5. So it's actually under control, a measure like that. So I would just throw that out there for discussion as a potentially a better measure. That would be a gap.
So just taking my chair hat off, I tend to agree that these are not ideal. I'm not as negative about 555. It may not flow like Shakespeare. I can't argue that. There's no sonnet writing going on. But one that says I've measured within a four-month interval as opposed to one that's telling me I'm at 2 months, 3 months, or 4 months. I've got more information if I know those comparative intervals, and yet I don't know that it's adequate if I don't understand not so much the upper limit of an INR, but how close you are within the target, within a confidence interval. And that's very difficult to do. But the ultimate outcome for a patient is if the INR target is 2, how often are you less than 1.5 or greater than 2.5? And that's really what I want to know, that I'm honing in on 2, and I'm working with you in your life and your diet and your other medications to get you as close to 2 as I can within a confidence interval. That's an ideal outcome measure for this medication. Saying that I didn't get to 5 means I avoided a catastrophic event, but it doesn't mean I really served your target area for your INR. And there's a list of conditions, and for each one of those conditions, there are target INRs. So for this disease, you want to be at this level. For this disease, you want to be at that level. And unfortunately, it's a gray schedule. It's not a black and white schedule. Kevin?
So that's what the VA created. It's called time in therapeutic range, and it's a measure of how much of your time you're between 2 and 3, essentially. And they found that if they focused on AFib patients, they were chronic, so they didn't have trouble with on and off and starts and stops. And they found that if you did well at monitoring AFib patients, you actually did well at everybody else. So they picked the measure with the cleanest indication and the clearest, the most chronic, and with the most consensus around the range. They then have a suite of 4 associated measures that are optional that if you're not performing well on the time and therapeutic range measure, you can put those other measures in, which are more process measures, which say what are the times that the intervals that you missed
They found that there's a high correlation if you go over 45 days between INR monitoring to being out of therapeutic range. So if you're not performing well in time in therapeutic range, then you apply this time that you missed INRs. So that we found that there's a nice bit of literature behind it, actually, that they have published. They just hadn't done the work of bringing it to the NQF for endorsement because the VA, you just picks programs for themselves, and this was busy expanding from one VISN to more VISNs.
So my own preference is I'm not wedded to any of these, and I do like the gap approach that the VA has taken. To me, it sounds more safe for patients. It sounds more clinical for the delivery system, and I would wonder if we can't move towards pointing out a gap area and moving the warfarin program to fill the gap. All right. One last area here, and that is the two blood incompatibility measures are in reserve status. So we don't really have measures unless anyone can identify a measure we don't have on the list to fill in for the blood incompatibility. So this area remains a gap, and I'm opening it up to ask if there's any measures we've missed that we need to consider and what the gaps may be to fill this in. Bill?
There's a question here that it's okay if I share that we both have the same question. What exactly does it mean to be in reserve status?
Sure. So this only applies to maintenance measures, so ones that have been in the portfolio for 3 years or more years. What we have found now that we've instituted the maintenance process is often the committee members look at the measures meet all of the criteria with the exception of the opportunity for improvement. So when they look at top-down, no variation, they look at the disparity data to make sure that's the case as well, and it's only used in rare circumstances. So these shouldn't be the ones, part of the recommendation is if it's in reserve status, these aren't the ones that you should go to first. We should just be monitoring and see and make sure performance doesn't in any way change and get impacted negatively. That makes
sense. Kevin, is your card up for this one?
No, sorry. That was up from last time.
All right. Well, if anyone has thoughts on this one that we need to come back to, please let us know. Otherwise, we'll move on in our schedule. We're going to get right back on track with a very quick review of all the rest. I want to get everyone out on time, so I think at this point in time, I think we have a very good sense of the framework we're in, and it's all about brevity. Make it count. Make it count. So our next area is I think it's obstetrics. And Tom is going to get us started on this. Tom?
Thank you, Frank. So as I mentioned yesterday in some of the setup overview that I did, one of the things that we're working hard to do is to connect the work of the National Priorities Partnership to the work of the MAP. These two NQF convened partnerships that both have roles in advising HHS and the field and in pulling our work together, so we're all rowing in the same direction in terms of priorities and activities to improve quality, as well as in terms of the measurement activities that we have to assess whether the efforts that we're putting into improving quality are actually making the difference that we're looking for. One of the ways that we're doing that is by having a liaison from the National Priorities Partnership sit on each of the MAP task forces. So I should mention that Laura Cranston, who is one of the NPP partners,
is that liaison back to the National Priorities Partnership larger group. And others around the table are also involved in the MPP work, so you should feel free to chime in. But I wanted to specifically focus in as we head into a section in our discussion guide that refers to obstetrical events, the work that the National Priorities Partnership has been doing in that area. It's under the umbrella of the National Priority Partnership support for the HHS Partnership for Patients initiative. Now, that is at core a patient safety-focused initiative, but because of the topics that are covered there, the actual area of priorities that gets covered here, as you can see through these four arrows on the slide, is broader than just patient safety. It includes person and family-centered care. It includes effective communication and care coordination. Also includes affordable care. So given this perspective and our experience yesterday and through the first part of today and the fact that we see a lot of bleeding, I don't know if that's the right word, a lot of overlap among our various categories that we've been discussing, it's not surprising that that this work would support more than just patient safety. But the focus of the National Priorities Partnership has been on, as I mentioned yesterday, both readmissions and obstetrical adverse events. And in terms specifically of obstetrical adverse events, an action team composed of MPP members as well as others who are important to the work of the maternity action team have been gathered to focus on putting together what the MPP has defined as an action pathway. An action pathway is basically the intervention as well as the actors and the timeline of how to get movement toward addressing goals under the specific priority. In this case, it's about reducing elective inductions and elective C-sections. So you see the goals on the right there in that orangish-colored box. And then the action team is working on pathways, which you see defined under the light blue arrows, of actions in order to achieve the goals. One has to do with uptake of the perinatal core measure set. This is a joint commission measure set that has been voluntarily reported, but is not one of the core measure sets that hospitals must report. And there's been a recommendation from this action team, as well as from individual members of the action team, like ACOG and our own Bill Kramer sent a letter from the Pacific Business Group on Health to the Joint Commission, that the perinatal measure set actually be required reporting under the standards for hospitals. In addition to that, you see the implementation of hard stop policies and checklists as being recommended there, and you see some of the specific actions that have been promoted by the action team as part of an action pathway. Also, alignment of consumer and provider messages. So I think the idea here is that what we're doing in terms of measurement for addressing maternity and perinatal care should reinforce some of these recommended interventions. And in fact, the perinatal core measure set that the action team has recommended, which includes these five elements, specifically the around the elective delivery and C-section for the maternity action team, but also you see three other elements, has been recommended as a way to monitor, promote, but also monitor the achievement of the goals that you saw on the last slide. So I know at least, Nancy, you're part of that maternity action team. I hope I'm not missing anyone else around the table who's a part of that. I don't know, Nancy, if you want to react based on your experience in being a part of that. But just wanted to introduce the folks to this connection between the MPP and the MAP work. Okay. Thanks, Nancy. Back to you, Frank.
Nancy, I love that brevity.
Yes.
So we have three commenters on this section. Andrea?
I feel like the pressure's on with regard to the brevity. Okay, so when I look at these measures, I'm going to go through them one by one. I think let me start with the ones that seem pretty straightforward to me and that I would recommend us moving forward with. The first metric is the antibiotics prior to C-section. I think that metric is fine. The controversial part of that metric has been whether the antibiotics are given, before incision or whether they're given after cord clamp. And I think if I recall how that metric is actually written, it encompasses whatever the doctor wants to do kind of thing, even though there are a couple of reasonable but small studies that reflect that it doesn't impact anything if you give it before incision as opposed to waiting for cord clamp, because there have been some concern that giving antibiotics would impact the babies because the antibiotic would be in the mother's system. So I think that metric has been controversial amongst obstetricians, but I believe has been endorsed by ACOG and is pretty straightforward. And I one of my overall recommendations around these kinds of things is we should just make sure that these are things that ACOG is in support of, and I don't know how we play that out. Appropriate DVT prophylaxis in women undergoing cesarean delivery, that measure has also is also pretty straightforward to me, and I think is solid. I do think that, again, this does measure adherence to current ACOG recommendations, so I would just want to make sure that those are in line with where ACOG's mind is. I'm going to skip over the next two, but PCO1, elective delivery prior to 39 completed weeks gestation, that metric I think has adequate details and adequate aspects to it that it makes sense to me. So those are the three on this list. Let me make sure it's on another page. That are relatively low-hanging fruit in my mind. Then if we go back to PCO2, which is the NULLIPS with a term single baby who's Vertex delivered by C-section. And so it's anything after 37 weeks without a contraindication. I think the one concern about that metric is that it's very dependent on coding practices, and I don't know how this metric truly plays out in practice, and I haven't seen any published data out of this, but this metric is very dependent on ICD-9 coding, including the contraindication has to be done by ICD-9 code. So I'm just not sure about that, and not sure that is that the right way to get at these contraindications for C-section. So I'm even just thinking, I looked at that code list at length last night. Not to get personal here, my sister-in-law had a baby a couple weeks ago at 41 weeks, 10-pound baby, and so they called me to say, well, the obstetrician is kind of hemming and hawing as to whether this should be C-section or vaginal and what should happen, but they were 41 weeks, and there are data that reflect the different percentages of shoulder dystocia at the different breakpoints for weight, and so 4,500 grams is about a breakpoint for weight anyway. So I do think that there are some that, and I looked specifically for that just as an example that I was recently familiar with, that is not on the list of potential reasons that you could choose. So I don't know what you would have put in that scenario. So I think that there are some potential flaws with that. This metric under 1,500 grams not delivered at the appropriate level of care, I'm not sure what this reflects on. And I believe there were some notes in the one of the recent reviews of this metric. I think I'm not sure who this reflects on, and it sort of disproportionately impacts urban areas, I think, because I'm not sure if this metric reflects that on the receiving hospital or on the delivering hospital. I think there needs to be more review of that metric. And then late sepsis or meningitis and very low birth weight neonates, this is a Vermont Oxford metric. I would not support using this metric for public reporting. It's a, Vermont Oxford is registry data with variable rigor around filling out these things. The Vermont Oxford data is not mandated. So I think there are steps to be taken before this measure made the list. Maybe the step is that you have to participate in a registry for neonates, and that might be a better type of metric to start to get at this. But I would not support that. The neonatal bloodstream infections, this one, 0478, this ARC metric, this is based on codes. This is based on billing codes. I do not think that's an adequate way to look at this. I think we should be using NHSN definitions. This is not an acceptable thing. Healthy term newborn, I'm not super familiar with this metric, and I didn't find it in detail, but I'm not clear what the definitions. Percent of term singleton live births who do not have significant complications. I don't know how well this metric is written. What does that define? How are significant complications defined? I'm not familiar with this particular metric enough to know that. And then the last one, PCO4, healthcare-associated bloodstream infections in newborns, assesses number of staff and gram-negative septicemias or bacteremias in high-risk newborns. This is based on billing codes. Again, I would not go this direction at all for these metrics. I would prefer that we spend the time and dig into the Vermont Oxford. The Vermont Oxford has a bloodstream infection metric, so I would rather have us, maybe start with a recommendation that places participate in a registry like Vermont Oxford and then move on to using that data. I also, as I'm thinking about it, I'm not sure if these neonates are reported to NHSN. I don't know that they are. NICUs, I'm not sure. That would be another route to go to get this data in a better fashion, because people are collecting it and are looking at it in other ways. So what's the kind of source for that is would need to be looked at. It needs to be stratified by weight class and other things. So that's where I stand on that. As far as the questions that were here, what patient safety areas could be addressed in the pre-delivery timeframe, there are a whole set of these. There's the steroids metric that is a Joint Commission metric that I understand is under revision, and perhaps that's why it's not on the list. There have been lots of other metrics. I wouldn't necessarily add them. I think I would start with this list, but there are lots of measures around prenatal care and documentation of prenatal care that in the future could potentially be considered. The question about are deliveries prior to 39 weeks and elective C-sections considered patient safety issues? I think certainly there are safety aspects to this around the children, and I don't have any major concerns about calling those safety issues. And then, again, the bloodstream infections, I think this needs to use sort of standardized NHSN type of definitions. And then overall, are there measurement gaps for obstetrical adverse events? The metric that has in practice probably made the most impact in obstetrical areas that have really used it and dug into it is the obstetrical adverse event index. My understanding is that it wasn't endorsed by NQF in part because there's some subjectivity to the manner in which the data is used and collected, and so I can see that. In my mind, that's almost it becomes sort of a structural thing. I think that these types of adverse event indexes can be hard to compare across sites. But there are several studies out there talking about the impact that using this kind of metric can have on your obstetrical practice. And certainly, we may put in there as a gap for the future that having that, using that type of an index may be a structural type of measure that we would be interested in places pursuing. So the short of it is that there's about three or four of these metrics, I guess three of them really, that seem pretty straightforward to me. And then, I would consider PCO2 sort of depending on what people really thought about it. And then the other ones I think need more work.
Thank you. Laura?
Okay. In the essence of brevity, I'm going to keep the NPP in mind as well as I go through this list. And on the first one, the 472, it's probably a really good measure, and it does, I think, impact. There's a third or fourth goal up there about reducing infections, I think, that they had up there. So it could fit into that category. Maybe not the first two priorities, which are the reduction in the election elective and the C-sections. But it could reduce healthcare-acquired conditions. The same thing for the second one. It's not a reduction in terms of what their overarching goals were, but, again, it would reduce healthcare-acquired conditions. And, gosh, you could move that to the DBT section if you wanted. We have a whole section on that. On the next one, which is the Joint Commission, which is one of the ones I think the National Partnership was recommending, that is a possible one for their goal number two. I agree that the coding is an issue. When we try to do claims review, I just did a huge claims review on postpartum care, and things are coded all over the place. And they can be coded in many different ways. So coding would be an issue to make sure that it was consistent. The next one I had same question marks on about the level of care. I wasn't quite sure, so I really don't want to comment on that. Obviously, it's some kind of a safety issue. And then the other Joint Commission, the 469, again, this would be in alignment with the National Partnership goals of the elective vaginal surgeries and the C-sections. But the coding, again, is going to be really critical the exclusions, I think, so sometimes the exclusions aren't in the right place when you're coding something. It might be too far down and the coder doesn't pick it up. And the rest are all bacterial and could be added later. As I said, there was a goal up there about infections and stuff, so maybe later they could be added. And I would just have to go with what Andrea said in her assessment of them because I was kind of thinking along the same lines. The one that the 716 could possibly fit with the NPP, again, I'm not too sure about that. It looks like it's out in California, so I'll find more about that later. Because we're actually going to be doing a big initiative with California. But so it does sound like it might fit into what the NPP is looking for as well. So.
Great. Thank you. Dan?
Well, I don't really have any specific comments as a federal rep ex officio to the group. From a personal note, I'm glad to see that NQF working with National Priorities Partnership, tying in HHS, the National Quality Strategy, Partnership for Patients, all of that, and trying to come up with some mutual measures that will cross all these areas. So, I salute that. I think that's very appropriate. But other than that, I guess I just have one informational question on 469, the TCO1 elective delivery. Why is that a process measure as opposed to an outcomes measure?
That's a great question.
How is that process?
So
it's how we calculate it?
Let me look at it again. We actually internally in the CDP staff have discussions that where some of these fall because
yeah.
A lot of times they're more perhaps an intermediate outcome on, and I think that's where it is. I think I need to go back to the staff and see. It's probably more of an intermediate outcome, and I think that we don't have that as an option, so the developer probably checks process, but at the end of the day, we would agree. I think we can clean that up.
Those are my only comments, thanks.
Okay, so as we open up the discussion, again, brevity, and let's focus on safety. And what are the safety aspects of these measures? There's an awful lot here that has to do with proper and appropriate care, but they're not necessarily the safety family. So what within these strikes you as the safety? Dana?
So first off, I think I can shed some light on 0477, the under 1,500 grand. I would assume that would have to do with birth center designation as a level 1, 2, or 3. and that a level one nursery designation and services would not be in a position to deliver a 1,500 gram neonate electively anyway, and that they should be arranging for transfer of services. Now, that said, I would ask the question, so how big of an issue is this? I mean, it's a patient safety and quality issue, undoubtedly, but how big of an issue is that, across the United States? And as our birth centers, with their designation and knowing their level of services, are they adhering to that, or is there a problem? And I don't know that information. So with not knowing that, I would not necessarily say that as a priority, and would agree with what Andrea is suggesting for the three top priorities for patient safety.
Amy?
For the first two measures, the DBT and the prophylactic antibiotics, I guess, it felt like when we were going through those earlier, we really had a bias towards outcome measures in those areas as opposed to looking at process measures. And I'd like to see that same thing in this area as opposed to a low-hanging fruit process measure, looking at what the actual outcome is. Was there an infection? Was there a VTE or a PE?
Thank you. Ron?
I have to say this. As an oncologist, I understand. But for as much as we talk about negative defect measures and so on, or defect measures, and I only know about 716, what's on the QPS and what's on the table. But it would seem to me, a very simple person, that the ultimate outcome measurement is to be born normal. I can't think of a better outcome measurement than that.
How do you define normal, Ron?
My mother's still commenting on that one.
You're asking, right?
She said no. Fancy?
I'll vote yes for you, Frank. I think that measure is highly complicated by the fact that lots of it doesn't have to do with the healthcare delivery system, That aside, so I would not be in favor of using that particular measure. I'm curious about the first two measures. Are they not subsumed in the surgical measures of the same thing? They're not.
They could be, but they're not.
They were developed after the SCIP measures based on ACOG had resisted for a while, I think, was my recollection.
So they didn't believe C-section was a surgery, or never, whatever. So I would be in favor of those and the TCO1. I think those are right on target. They're critically important. TCO1, because we're reducing early elective deliveries, many of which occur via C-section, getting at the C-section. In an effort that has been supported, that has good patient outreach materials, so the patients don't feel like we're taking away something that they wanted. We're helping them to understand why this is in their interest and in their child's interest. So, to me, this is where we ought to be focused. These three things.
So you're on. I'm sorry. 469. Is that right?
The first two, 472, 473, and 469. Yeah.
Okay. I think there were distinctions on those first two. One was due to both of these are in unique settings in that there are two patients involved, and rather than one, and there were considerations for two patients and how we approach them. So they were carved out separate from those other aggregate measure sets. And was there an implication? Does it turn out to be a difference? I think that they've left them separate so that there's always a consideration that there's two patients. And I think Andrea raised some of that when do we apply the antibiotics at cross clamp or do we apply them before the data suggesting that it's probably no risk to the baby to apply them before. It may not be protective of anything, but there's no adverse events related to it. To the
VTE, it was a risk of associated bleeding from sections. And again, it's kind of a different discussion from other patient scenarios. So they've just been carved out. Whether we want to include them as a safety measure, it might be appropriate care, but it is a safety measure. Richard?
So I agree with Andrea and Nancy. I do think the first two are appropriate for safety. I agree the elective prior to 39 as a safety measure. And I would like to understand, try to go on the site and look for the specs, and I can't seem to find them. Defined, I think it could be potentially useful.
Is 716 safety perspective measuring inversely the non-healthy? I'm not quite sure I follow the safetyness of measuring healthy, but we're really interested in knowing what's our unhealthy and why. Bill?
First, I really appreciate the analysis that Andrea and Laura did. It was very, very helpful. But I find myself diverging somewhat in my recommendations on this. Again, from a public reporting and payment perspective, from the views of what is useful to purchasers, I question whether the publishing the process measures 472 and 473 would be a high priority. Unquestionably, they're useful within the hospital systems. I think what is most useful are the outcome measures. So certainly PCO1, 469. I think also PCO2, number 471, and number 477 are all very good endorsed outcome measures that, while some of them have cost implications, like PCO2 and PCO1, they also have safety issues. And so I strongly recommend that we include those three. And then one additional one would be the one we just mentioned, Frank, which is number 716. And it is, you're right, the inverse of a safety measure. But it is, again, endorsed, tested, and well used in California. The other...
Bill, I've got, I missed one of yours. I have 471, I have 469, I've got 716.
477 also.
Thank you. Did you have one more? Okay. Sure.
So I can tell you for 716, it was in the patient outcomes project, so it was a while ago, which may be why you can't find it, Richard. Data. So it was using, tested using HCUP data, and the reason why they did it is much easier to turn anything else. So, and their exclusions and everything, I can get into more details if you'd like.
So what I have on the list right now is the measures with some dispute, and the three outcomes measures about the bottom of 20, so all three, and then 716 on page 26. Andrea?
In the interest of parsimony for this, the measures, I would agree with Bill that for public reporting and payment to focus on the outcome measures. And so with the exception of the first two you mentioned, the other four, I would agree with.
I have a question, Heidi, on the antibiotics. Is there a stop order on this? On prophylactic antibiotics in a C-section? Okay. Because I think, as I recall our discussion yesterday, we did not go with the process measure other than the stop order, because we thought that was the safety component. And it linked back to the ordering measure and the delivery measure. So to be consistent, if there's a stop order, I'm just wondering if that shouldn't be our antibiotic focus.
This is more of an SSI measure than a, I mean, it's.
No, it's a safe, we looked at it as a safety measure in stopping inappropriate use of antibiotics.
Right, that's the overuse piece. That's the one that's like the equivalent of skip three, the
correct.
Antibiotic stop. Yeah.
Correct.
My recollection of this measure is that it's the equivalent to sort of the combination of, I don't remember whether it has,
I haven't,
the choice, antibiotic choice.
Right, so this one looks at women who have C-section who receive the antibiotics within 1 hour before start of C-section. They do get credit if a patient's already receiving appropriate antibiotics. So that's all it looks at. It doesn't look at anything beyond the close of this.
But is there another
similar
measure for stop order?
No.
Does the stop order measure exclude C-section?
Let me look at that.
Yeah, I mean, that stop order measure just applies to those surgeries that are in the skip thing. What's those, you know?
We're wondering what the specs say.
Yeah.
If the specs don't exclude it, then it could be put on the inclusion list. And then we would be consistent. We don't have to worry about whether they ordered them and whether they got them. They'd be picked up if they didn't discontinue them. That was
right. Although I thought that skip three metric only applied if you started them.
It does, but our recommendation was to spec it so that it doesn't, you don't get caught in that catch 22. Anne-Marie?
I just have a question about all the infection ones that we seem to think. The last one that's part of that package that's being promulgated, I mean, have they been collecting data? Has the data been that bad, or they really haven't been collecting it yet? The one on number 1731, where it's part of the that group of data which is out there that people are putting together? Because I think if we kill all the infection ones, then I think we at least have to talk about that being a serious gap, and that maybe we ought to come up with a way to measure these that are is reasonable going forward. And
so,
if claims data isn't ideal, although lots of times claims data isn't ideal. Are we going to drop all the infection ones?
No, what I was thinking about with the infection ones is that these would roll into our sepsis effort.
Okay, that's fine.
We identified a future need for us to look at sepsis, and we're going to have a neonate and a pediatric opportunity.
As long as they're in there.
If we could just pull those into that.
That would be fine. That would be fine, as long as they're included somewhere.
Then we'll be consistent on our sepsis methodology when we take a look across all
that's
the sepsis.
Great. That's great.
Nancy?
For mine, I need Heidi, so maybe I could circle back to make a few things.
Give me a minute. The website is slow. It's not keeping
up
with me.
All right. Richard?
I just want to ask if looking at the C-section rate really falls under safety. I mean, I guess it could, since it might be an inappropriate surgery, but it seems like it's more, it doesn't seem to be safety. And the under 1,500 grams, to me, that seems like more of an issue of access to care and prenatal care, and whether or not someone shows up on your doorstep without any prenatal care and delivering an under-term baby. So I'm not so sure that's safety either. So I just want to raise those questions.
So I think Dana was talking about this earlier. It's not so much that prenatal care failure. It was more that when you identify maternal situation with a low birth weight infant, that infant is born in a facility where the care system is at low birth weight infant. And it was a safety measure in trying to get that baby transported before birth, so that there's a neonatal team to take care of that baby. And we don't have a rural baby in trouble and no neonatal care system nearby. If I understood that. Amy?
The other aspect of
477 is that, again, it's another one of those measures where you can kind of look at the health plan. And a lot of health plans have kind of a care coordination effort to get involved in high-risk maternity. So this is an area where, you know, if they need to kind of put some things in place to just make sure from their perspective that access issue is kind of hold them accountable.
You're in support of. Are we ready yet? Helen?
I would like to argue in favor of keeping one of the infection measures, probably the ARC one. I think it's really an important measure. I know that, you know, sepsis in newborns is a peculiar sort of diagnosis, but I think that to capture the bloodstream infections, I don't know exactly why they need to be specifically restricted to high-risk newborns. But, I don't see how that could be more straightforward to a diagnosis code of bloodstream infection on discharge. And then the other thing that I would like to say is that I have some qualms about the 472 and 473. And if you were saying that ACOG had expressed reservations about giving antibiotics to delivering mothers, and that only small studies had shown safety. Now, I'm wondering if that's something you really want to be measuring. And same thing with DBT prophylaxis, VTE prophylaxis, that it. You know, again, I have questions about whether you want to be really forcing these issues when you've got two parties involved.
The issue on the C-sections was more of when, not if, and was it prior to, at the time of incision, an hour before incision, or was it at the point of cross-clamping the placenta?
Right. If you're cross-clamping, then the baby is out.
Right.
And this is saying before.
Right, but the reason they pulled it out of the other prophylaxis measure, was to allow for discussion on the two patients, and then the conclusion ended up here.
Yeah. I guess I was just concerned at the end of the two small studies that worried me as being the only evidence.
I mean, I think that these this metric is written so that you can give the antibiotics at either time. Heidi can back me up on this, but this metric is written so that you can either give it prior to incision or at the time of cord clamp, or, you know, after cord clamp. I think the studies that were done were pretty reasonable. I think this is one of the never-ending trial situations with evidence-based care in pregnant women and in babies, is that she kind of wants to risk, you know, the impact on a pregnant woman. That's why these things get delayed and in the creation of them, because you're dealing with X number of additional years of potential life that you could. So that's why these things get delayed. But I think this has been pretty well accepted over the past 4 or 5 years. Again, I would want to, and there are studies, I think people are starting to try to look at impact on babies and impact on the amount of culturing of the baby. What can happen is if people are concerned that it causes the culture of the baby, so then babies may have more workups and that kind of thing. So those, you know, people are starting to look at this. I do have a couple other comments.
Sure.
I think I want to be really clear about these infection measures. People look at central line associated bloodstream infections in neonatal ICUs, and they do it using Vermont Oxford typically. It's a registry. Most, you know, real sort of big NICUs are in Vermont Oxford. There are a couple of other, there's at least one other large neonatal registry. And so I do not think that there's any role for having these they would be measured by claims data or any other fashion other than using the real NHSN definitions and that, you know, those types of definitions. So I think we have to be really cautious. These things are being looked at. They are being drilled into, and there's no role for these other metrics.
Are they being reported publicly?
You know, my understanding is I just don't remember what the – and it's too bad that Chesley isn't here because I don't think NICUs have to report. PICUs do and other ICUs do, but I don't think NICUs have to report to the states. You know, I think maybe that's a piece of that conversation that we could be just like other ICUs that you have to report and, you know, using the Vermont Oxford or NHSN methodology. That is a perfectly reasonable metric, and I think most people would agree with that. The risk adjustment then is done by weight classes and et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think there's any role for using these other things that are on this list at all. And I knew I had seen some comments on here. This is from the voting draft report that I was able to pull up. So this is the under 1,500 grams, the infant not delivered at the appropriate level of care. You know, this is developer noted that in their use of this measure, urban hospitals were less likely to perform well than rural ones, and also noted the performance on this measure is not intended to be zero. Measure data is collected from simple administrative data, does not require chart review. I think I always have a concern about metrics that we're not, especially for this purpose, where we're not clear what the goal is. So if the goal isn't zero or the goal isn't 100, for this type of purpose, it's really tricky. So I think in general, it's good to have those kinds of things so that you can understand them in your work. That's not the same for our purpose. So I do not think that that makes sense to use that metric. And so I don't think that just because things are labeled an outcome metric that we should use them if they're not good metrics. So I want to just put that word of caution out there.
Go for it.
Sorry, it took so long. So for 529, it does not include C-sections at all. It's nowhere in the denominator. I went through the whole cold list. Not there. 529, which is the one Frank was hoping you could.
All right. So, Nancy?
And Lance helped me with the healthy germ newborn one, which I also find out probably tell you the truth. You're looking puzzled. This is number 716.
Okay, thank you.
716. If we were talking about this as a measure of the overall system rather than attributing it to any one facility or group, then I could see the value in it. But having a healthy newborn is clearly one of those parts of the health, parts of living that reflect a wide variety of inputs, including the patient, including the local resources, including prenatal care if it's acquired, so forth and so on. So I'm struggling with what to do with it here and now as we're talking about applications to various programs that reflect pieces of healthcare system.
Well, I didn't mean to be, but I will say that I like the healthy newborn.
I like a healthy newborn, too. All right. So we're getting close to consensus. It seems like we have reasonable consensus on page 25 on the outcome measures. At least the 471 and 469. I'm actually not hearing an overwhelming lack of consensus on 477. I'm tending to believe that all three of those outcomes are in our consensus. I think we're kind of mixed on the process measures on the very first page, the antibiotics and the DVT, and we can look at those in view of what we did on the others. The major difference was the other DVT measure from yesterday dealt with a need to address the new literature in mechanical compression, and this one has got mechanical compression, I believe, as a one of its key components again, pneumatic compression. So I don't know if we'd be inconsistent then across the rest of adults and C-sections, and I'd rather that we had consistency in our logic. And then to the question of sepsis, I think the sepsis one we can look at and say, are we going to choose a sepsis one now, or are we going to address sepsis in our subsequent meeting? And I see three sepsis measures there, and I would, if we're going to choose one now, I would rather say which one of these three is the optimal sepsis. They're all very similar. They all have some sense of risk stratified baby and related sepsis events. They come about it through different data sources, but they all tend to be out.